If you take this away from any person or any group of people, you have no country, freedom. You have no religion. You have no sound money. You don't have any of it. You're subject to the control of the people who have taken your freedom away and who are now subjecting you to their will, because that's what lack of freedom is. Being subject. You know what subject means? To someone else's will. Freedom means you're subject to your own will. As long as what? As long as you take responsibility for your actions and you never hurt the person or property of any other human being. Period. If you do, you put yourself at war with someone else. Is that freedom? No. Then you're taking someone else's freedom away. You have become the bad guy when you do that.
This is Bristol. It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock, and welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on the 15th of December 2023, streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft Arts Centre in Bristol, on the talkradio.org.uk stream, at radioqUK.com in Camberley, Surrey. Well, there's a streamer that's going to get a little something in the post over the next few days. Thank you very much, James Henry House, for restreaming us live every week from Camberley, Surrey, and also, of course, live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, available free from all good app stores. Please not the Google Play Store, though, which asks you for your blood group if you want to download anything from it. And also, they've started prohibiting lots of apps which they don't like. You can't even get them from the Play Store anymore. But there's something else called the Aurora Store on Android, which does a very good job. And you log on to it anonymously, and it's got all the old apps too. So avoid Google like the plague, if you ask me. I'm Tony Gosling. And thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its propaganda psyops, the puff pieces on the conspirators, and the hatchet jobs on the heroes, it seems to be most of the time. McCarthyite witch hunts going after anyone with influence who speaks up for humanity and against the World War III agenda. So joining us this week in the studio, we've got Vice President of one of the trade unions, and he's also the deputy leader of the Workers' Party. That's, well, better known as George Galloway's party. That's Andy Hudd. And also Dr. Philippa Winkler, who's an international relations researcher, and she has a Substack too. So I think we'll start with you, Philippa, if you don't mind. Tell us a little bit about your career. How did you end up being an international relations researcher, and have you done lecturing, that sort of thing?
Yes, I have. And I've published some books.
So what got you interested in all that?
Well, I've been an activist for most of my life, and it got to a point where I needed to theorize my activism, so to speak, and so I did a PhD, which was about going to the United Nations and raising the issue of the draconian sanctions against the Iraqi people, which was happened in the 90s. So I sort of initiated a project to raise awareness about the use of depleted uranium munitions against the Iraqi people, and also about the blockade that was on the Iraqi people for 13 years, and to go to the United Nations to Human Rights Commission, which is what it was called at the time, to raise awareness and to start kick off a campaign about that.
So is it fair to say that you started off with the kind of emotions of someone that wanted to do something, but then decided, right, I'm going to need to articulate this, and went and did your PhD?
Exactly right.
Yeah, very much like Dr. Judith Brown, who we have on this show from time to time. She was somebody who had a similar sort of trajectory. I think it's very helpful to force yourself to actually write stuff down sometimes, isn't it? And to, rather than, and almost to take the emotion out of it and get it down in almost, I mean, it might sound boring, but a legalistic form.
I think it's very important to frame your activism, like what's causing the issue, what's the problem. And I come from a background of political economy, which is a sort of euphemism for Marxism. So basically, I look at where the money is and why did this war happen in Iraq? You know, the first Gulf War and then the second Gulf War. What's the motivation? And you know, basically, the research that I did came down to something that was very simple. simple. It was the oil. It was about the oil. And that's political economy for you. It's about profit, access to oil, control over access to oil.
Yeah, there wasn't actually that much talk in Iraq about that. It was all to do with weapons of mass destruction and we have the right principles and that kind of thing.
Which they never found.
Of course, which were never there, indeed. So, Andy, what about you? How did you get into the trade union movement and now into being deputy leader along with George Galloway of this small left-wing party?
That's a story. I'm probably better done in a pub over a beer, I think. But, I mean, a very potted history is, you know, born and bred in Avonmouth, well, Southampton, technically, but I joined the Navy when I was 17. And I'd done 10 years service. When I left, I realised that I could think for myself. And that some of the things I was, familiar with in the armed forces was probably no longer relevant. And that actually there's a different world out there.
Were they trying to drum that out of you in the Navy? I mean, surely the idea was you do as you're told.
Well, yeah. I mean, I said, you're pretty much told how to think. And even when you go on deployments elsewhere, around the world, you know, you're given briefings on, you know, literally what the situation is. But of course, it's from, you know, the kind of West point of view. And I always knew that there was something not quite right with what I was being told. But when I left, of course, I had access to lots of things like the real world and books and just started reading and got interested in an alternate world where, you know, of socialism.
Well, I wonder whether sailors press-ganged into the Navy from here in Bristol, etc., back hundreds of years ago had a similar experience, that they went out there and think there's something not quite right about this. I'm not sure I really believe in the people running this.
Yeah, well, of course, and it's there's something, I think, in every human being where you just realise that something's not right. But, it's like the very idea that at 17 years old I felt that the only way to go and travel, because we have a very poor family, and it's a very, you know, it's a very, still is a very poor area. To get out of that, the idea that you'd go and work in ICI or the smelting works, or, you know, that was the kind of role that was destined for me. And the idea that the only way out of that is what someone actually coined for me was you're an economic conscript. You know, you're. You just want to get out of the area, and that's, you join the armed forces to do that.
What, tell us a bit about the Workers' Party.
Yeah, well, the Workers' Party, I joined about, about 8 months, a year after it was set up, and I, like many people, joined the Labour Party when I seen the manifesto and the move to the left with the election of Jeremy Corbyn as leader. And I was really infused by that. I knew it wasn't perfect, but I at least saw that I could deliver meaningful change in my lifetime. And if I could be a part of that, then I would. But of course, you know, the forces at work got rid of him in rather short shrift, and the kind of, you know, the dream of a better world kind of disappeared with
that. Well, hang on, because wasn't it the voters that got rid of him? I mean, he had a chance in 2017 to prove himself to the nation.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think everybody who was
and he lost.
Yeah.
Well, we know why.
I think everybody who was in the party at the time realized, well, knew what was going on, and you know, there was a deliberate campaign to undermine absolutely everything he'd done. The media was against him. His politicians on his own front bench were against him, for the love of God. And I think, you know, the message and the manifesto for 2017 was fantastic. And, if you took all those swing seats, I think he lost by about 2,000, 3,000 votes, which is shameful, because that was the work of being, you know, that was being undermined by his own party that done that. It wasn't him himself or the manifesto. People loved the manifesto.
Actually, he was seen at the time as a rock star, wasn't he? He was going around the country with thousands of people turning out just to sort of like almost touch his shirt.
Yeah, exactly.
Philippa, what do you make of the whole Corbyn business?
Well, he was accused of anti-Semitism. He had clearly a campaign was run, I think, by Israeli agents. This is what came out in the Channel 4 dispatches program, that the Israel embassy had been employing people to shift people's opinion within the Labour Party, and this is a very serious problem. And then once he was tainted with this anti-Semitism business, that was it. He had the what I call the right wing of the Labour Party, the pro-Zionist part of the Labour Party, on his back, and they ran a concerted campaign to run him out.
So you yourself are Jewish?
Yes, I am.
So what do you make of the whole anti-Semitism thing? Are you one of those people that gets labelled as a self-hating Jew?
Actually, that's exactly what has happened to me. I was actually on a list of self-hating, Israel-threatening Jews, but there was 2,000 of us academics. But I'm happy to say that Noam Chomsky was on that list and some other very celebrated Jewish academics.
So what do you make of this whole phenomenon? I mean, we've had David Miller from Bristol University. I mean, I think he's one of the greatest sociologists I've ever come across. I always have a great chat with him, as well as we have, you know, terrific interviews here. We hear fascinating insight from him, particularly into the so-called experts we see on our television screens and who's really paying for them, who's behind them. The fact that so many of them are, in fact, lobbyists that are being put up by the TV companies as independent experts. So what do you make of this whole anti-Semitism phenomenon?
Well, basically, it's been conflated with anti-Zionism. I mean, if you're critical of Israel in any kind of way, you are labelled as an anti-Semite. And that's a deliberate ploy that's, I think, used by Israel to get a popular vote on its side by saying, if you criticise Israel, then you're criticising all Jews. And really and truly, when Zionism began, when the movement started in the late 19th century, most Jews had nothing to do with it. They weren't involved in Zionist movement. In fact, they didn't want to be moved to someplace else where they wanted to stay assimilated in the European countries
There were quite a few European Jews that refused to go and then were herded into concentration camps.
Well, they didn't refuse to go. They didn't have the means to go, maybe. I'm not exactly sure.
There was quite a lot of migration in the early 1930s because there was an impetus from the Nazis after they came to power to actually help to do deals with Zionists, basically to help with immigration in one way or another over to Israel.
Yeah. Well, I'm not exactly familiar with that history.
Well, Martin,
but
do you want to say something about that? Because I think this is quite a key part of the history, I think, that many of us need to understand, that Nazis were involved with Zionism to a certain extent in the 30s.
The history of this is convoluted, as I'm sure you are aware. But, I mean, Zionism, as you say, was a minority strain within international people who identified as Jews, because, of course, they themselves are very varied. It was assimilationist in the sense that it was a secularist movement and it was nationalist, but it was nationalist about a country which didn't belong to them, which was a bit of, you know, obviously creates a bit of a tension. I could go. What's really encouraging to me at the moment, actually, Jennifer, is to look in the United States for the Jews for Peace. Young Jews who are obviously observant Jews, you know, they're dressed in a very observant fashion. They're being led by their young rabbis, and they're not just saying we're going to trail along with the rest of the demonstrators here. They're going out as a block and tackling and doing really militant stuff, and that is by far the best answer to any accusations of anti-Semitism. Yeah. And they, of course, are protecting Jews all over the world by doing that, because people can see that and they respect it all over the world.
And we're going to be coming back to this whole topic of Gaza and maybe a bit more about anti-Semitism. It's Philip, by the way, Martin, in a moment. But we're going to start by looking at the rather shock news this week. Well, I don't know if it's not necessarily a shock to many of our listeners, that the UK economy has gone into surprise decline in October. Before we hear this, Martin, I mean, I know you're one of those people that thinks that a lot of this is to do with Brexit, aren't you?
Well, Brexit isn't a helping, Tony. I'm not saying it's only Brexit. You've got an international financial crisis and the Americans blowing up the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which is basically a knife in the throat of the European economy. So let's not just reduce it all to Brexit, but it's quite clear that Brexit hasn't helped. The suggestion that it has helped is absurd.
What the Victorians left behind, many of us still call home, but the architecture of that very different era could be hiding behind its doors the risk of Britain slipping back to a time of two nations, that Victorian age gap between mainstream society and an impoverished underclass. Not some tiny minority either, but more than 13 million people. The impact of lockdowns during the pandemic, according to the Centre for Social Justice, which produced the report, is that life is going backwards for many, with staggeringly high numbers experiencing mental health conditions.
Deep in my heart, there's a trembling question.
None of it is any surprise to people like Bobby, the man in this video made by a charity on Teesside.
How I look at things now, and I think to myself, well, could things actually get any worse than what they are now?
Yeah. It works to get former prison inmates into jobs.
Getting out of the care which is provided for you, that is your biggest hurdle, getting out of that, getting away from it and getting into something else, being able to step away from it, that is your biggest hurdle.
What we don't want to paint is a picture of a region that's on its knees without any due care for itself. But it's the gap, isn't it? It's these disparities from what's happening in one place and what's happening down the road is significantly different.
During the lockdown, at the end of lockdown, a massive rise in the amount of people drinking alcohol and the amount of people using the cocaine. So that had an effect on it. People who were lonely, bored, lost, started drinking more.
It's clear the need is growing.
The report paints a picture of lives marred by family fragility, stagnant wages, poor housing, chronic ill health and crime. The most disadvantaged in Britain are no better off than they were 15 years ago at the time of the financial crash. There's evidence that moving from welfare into work just isn't worth it for many people. And the report's authors say there is no sign that help is on the way.
They also say our political culture is mired in a sense of pessimism and decline, and that with a general election on the horizon, the country desperately needs answers on how to close that gap between the rich and poor. Greg Milam, Sky News.
So that's a report from Sky this week about the general state of the economy. Now, this is something you, as a trade unionist, I know, have been engaged with quite a lot, haven't you? Particularly via ASLEF, who are on strike, I think. But anyway, can you just give us your analysis of what's going on with the economy? Because it doesn't seem like wages are keeping pace with inflation at all, with the cost of living at all. And there is this need for migrant workers because basically wages are so low. But what's your take on it?
Yeah, well, I think, Brexit certainly hasn't helped. And, I think what we've got to take into context is the whole idea of the European Union prior to Brexit, and it's because it's still the same. The idea of a super capitalist economic bloc that basically divvied up kind of means of manufacture and production and stuff like that meant that, the UK was pretty much deindustrialized to the point where, when we face a crisis like we have done with COVID and the mismanaged Brexit and our exit from Europe, what we have got is a deindustrialized country, a service economy that can't cope with the rigors of that.
Okay, well, look, because that might be to do with the European Union, but it might also be to do with Margaret Thatcher getting rid of exchange controls and foreign investors coming in and just buying stuff up. I mean, they would be able to do that with or without Brussels.
Well, yeah, Brussels was actually, my union, which I'm not speaking on behalf of, but we recognized at the time that the fourth railway directive was lock, stock and barrel privatization of UK rail. Now we had it already, but the whole of Europe was going to be privatized in that matter. And I think that was the main reason. It was the social contract that was set up, in the European Union that was meant to combat those elements of capitalism, was eroded and to the point where, it's rampant capitalism and the privatization of everything in every country was the logical next step.
Since you're an expert at this, can you just talk a little bit about this new privatized rail system? Well, it's not that new. John Major, it was, I think, in the 90s that did it. We've got various layers, haven't we? We've got Network Rail at the bottom, I think it is. Then you've got the rolling stock companies. Is it the Roscoes?
Yeah.
Then you've got the train operating companies. Each of them has got their very well paid bosses and their shareholders all taking their cut out of the system. So if you could check, what's the main problem that we're having? Because quite clearly, it's far, far too expensive to travel. If you want to go to Scotland on the train, it's something like £200-£250 return.
Yeah, right. I mean, look, when it was privatised, what was it, 94, early 90s anyway, the process was started, you know, the line was then was it was to reduce the burden on the taxpayer. But the burden's, you know, just exponentially grown. The burden on the taxpayers, I'd love to have the figures, but exceptionally more than what it was then. And what you do have, like with every, you know, we believe in the Works Party that, you know, every public service should be under public ownership. And what you do have with these private companies, and most of them foreign-owned, are basically leaking money out of the system through profit. And, you know, the idea of competition is completely bogus as well, because you do have mini monopolies in areas around the country that the TOCs can pretty much, train operating companies, that is, can do what they want. So the money's leaking out of the system every day, every year.
Well, I can help you with the figures. The government's direct subsidy of British Railways is around £5 billion a year, an increase of 200% since privatisation. Well, there you go, some figures for you. Well, okay, so what do you make of all this, Philippa? This particularly, I suppose we sum it up and call it a cost of living crisis, but for many people it's just simply that they can't pay the rent anymore, they're getting evicted.
Well, I mean, we're living in a society where profit is the king. You know, it's the power. So what we're seeing is a disparity in income since, for the last 20 years, 30 years, where the gap has got, the income gap has just got wider and wider and wider. And to me, this is a function of capitalism.
What would Karl Marx have to say about that then?
Well, he predicted it. He said this was going to happen.
I mean, it was happening, wasn't it, in Victorian times, actually, and in the beginning of the century. You know, if you read George Orwell, you'll see the same sort of thing going on.
It's been predicted,
Martin?
Well, obviously, I generally agree with all of that stuff. I think the economy at the moment is... We're with the blowing up of the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which we're pretty, you know, I'm pretty confident that was the Americans who carried it out. Seymour Hersh has got the contacts. He gave a blow by blow account of how it was done. And of course, that was news all over the rest of the world. But you'd be, you know, you'd be talking to people in the pubs this Christmas. People have forgotten about it. And they said, well, why, what, but they can remember, they can't pay their bills. They're worried about being evicted. They can't get to see the doctor. But the Americans blew the pipeline up. And Rachel Reeves won't be talking about this. She's, you know, she'll just be, what, pipeline? I forgot about the pipeline. Because they've got this tunnel vision. I just do economics. Like, this is the way they think. And it's not because they know and they are somehow manipulated. They've just been chosen because they've got that mindset where they don't look at the bigger picture at all. Most people don't. And it's not surprising they don't, because it's too big for most people. And even people who do look at it don't feel very confident anything can be done about it.
Also, we're never discussing these things. It frustrates me when I'm listening to the radio and people don't do it, is what do we do about it?
What do we do about it? Well, I think we historically what we do is we resist, we protest, we demonstrate. And there's two ways. You know, it's like with Hamas, for example, if I could just bring it back to Hamas. So Hamas is the Islamic resistance movement. And what we have to understand, there's a right to resist. Okay, so the right to resist can either be civil disobedience or it could be armed resistance. So historically, that's what's happened. So what we're seeing, I think, right now are strikes. We're seeing a preponderance of strikes in the last year. I've never heard of so many in I think in 30 years. We've had the nurses, the teachers, the railway people coming out practically at the same time. And this is what's going to push forward political consciousness. What the bloc is, as I see it, is the Labour Party, particularly Keir Starmer, who was brought in to basically get rid of Jeremy Corbyn, get rid of any kind of socialist principles. And he's the major blockage. I'm not sure how to overcome this, because you've got this loyal opposition, basically. The Labour Party is a loyal opposition. How do we move out of that quandary? I'm not exactly sure. I'm looking at the Greens Party. The Green Party actually is very good on Gaza. They basically have come out to say, you know, immediate ceasefire, which Keir Starmer hasn't, which is completely disgraceful. I think we have to look at the Green Party to see if we can't build it up. That's my only that's what I can offer right now.
Well, also, one of the things that I don't hear mentioned, it was mentioned on talk radio I was listening to this morning, so one of the commentators said, well, we need to tax the super rich, don't we? And immediately got shut down. Right, that's the end, we're talking about something else now. And that's, I think, you know, pretty basic stuff. Now, you're there talking about Gaza. Before we hear the next clip, I'd like to hear from one of our local councillors here in Bristol, because I'd like to do things in order. She spoke just before the next people we're going to hear from at the council meeting here, what they call the full council on a Tuesday, usually in the middle of the month. And last month, the full council meeting in Bristol, which usually takes about 2, 3 or 4 hours, is where all the so-called decisions get made. Well, actually, they get made by the mayor nowadays. But it is a chance for the 70 or so elected councillors to discuss matters as well as take questions from the public. So it's a well worthwhile. But we had last month's November full council cancelled at the last minute because of the evacuation of Barton House, which is a 400 people live there. And early that morning, they suddenly said, after several years of shilly-shally over a letter sent to them from central government and not acting on this letter, asking them to check the structural integrity of the building, which they hadn't done, the council said, oh no, we're just going to have to evacuate everybody now. And so those people have been being put up in hotels, some of them sleeping in cars, and indeed some of them still in the building itself. So just before that happened, or we heard about that at the council, one of the Labour councillors, Zoe Goodman, had this to say, a petition that she personally as a councillor put forward about Gaza. And just to let you know, at the beginning of this, and beginning of October, the mayor decided to project the Israeli colours of the Israeli flag up onto the council house. And on Tuesday this week, a little protest outside, they had a projector and they projected the Palestinian colours onto the council house. So that's perfectly fair, both sides. So let's have a listen now to what Zoe Goodman, the former Labour councillor, had to say this week.
There's been one councillor petition received for this meeting. Councillors are invited to speak for 1 minute. So, Zoe, would you like to present the petition?
Thank you, Lord Mayor. Our petition on the Israel-Gaza conflict has been signed by 4,859 verified Bristol signatories, showing the strength of feeling of Bristol on this issue. The petition calls for an immediate ceasefire and lifting of the siege to end the humanitarian disaster in Gaza, and for Bristol's political representatives to add their voices to this call and to push towards a just political settlement. Also, a minute silence at full council to commemorate all those killed in the atrocities, and for City Hall to be lit up in Palestinian colours to express empathy for those who have lost their lives or been injured. It shouldn't require a petition to be brought for these things to happen. We're glad that a minute silence was held earlier, and thank you for that. We believe that the other petition request should not be controversial either, and we would like to ask all here to support this petition when it is debated on the 9th of January if the demands have not been acted already. Unfortunately, as a result of how the genocide in Gaza and our response to it has been treated by the National Labour Party and some of those in the local Labour group, I'm resigning from the Labour Party today. Free Palestine, free Gaza, ceasefire now.
Thank you, Zoe.
So interesting the way they cut the. I didn't cut that applause. She actually got a lot of applause, but they cut off the recording of the council meeting just as people start to applaud. I think they just don't like anybody to know. But I mean, in a way, this has been a protest because the council haven't projected the Palestinian colours onto the council house. This is the pro-Palestine campaigners in Bristol that have had to do that.
I think the pro-Palestine campaign has been fantastic. I mean, they've come out in great droves of people on the street. We also have organizations like Na'amod, which are the British Jews Against Israeli Occupation. That's N-A-M-O-D. There's another wonderful group that I'm in touch with. I'm also working with Women in Black. So Women in Black, they stand 3 times a week in vigil outside the council building for about an hour with placards and then talking to people about what's going on. And I've I've stood outside with them vigiling, and everybody who passes has nothing but sympathy and compassion with what's going on with Gaza. We've not had any problems at all. Just people have offered us cups of tea and all sorts. So I think there's a lot of feeling here in Bristol for the people in Gaza.
I mean, Zoe Goodman resigning, though, is it really going to make any difference? I mean, many would say, well, OK, so she's just a Labour councillor that's on her way out. She won't be selected next time. And so her political career is over.
Yeah, I don't know. That's her personal choice. You know, people do activism in different ways. Personally, I would have stayed within to keep fighting. But, you know, that's up to her. You know, I think that people are leaving the Labour Party anyway. I mean, I personally know of at least, you know, five people who've just said, I've had it with the Labour Party because of this awful stance they have.
Martin, you're still in, aren't you?
I am, yeah. My philosophy is they'll have to drag me out feet first. I think that's Jeremy Corbyn's position at the moment. He's been suspended from the Labour Party, but his position is, I'm not going to make it easy for them by resigning. Because, of course, the problem is the electoral system is a rigged system. It's not a democratic system.
Actually, Andy, yes. It makes it impossible for you and the Workers' Party to do anything, does it? It's a minority party.
Not impossible to do anything.
First past the post means you're almost starting off as an irrelevance, really.
No. Well, in fact, you know, we'll have Zoe, and we'll have the 36 councillors that also resign the Labour Party. We'll have them. You know, we'll welcome them with open arms, and I think that's what is needed, that groundswell, the realisation that Labour Party are, you know, Labour in name only, Lino. You know, all of those people who are disenfranchised with the Labour Party, you're more than welcome, because, you know, we're adopting a stance of common sense socialism, and, you know, we're going to be what the Labour Party should have been. You know, we've got such a diverse membership that we'll quite happily take those under 36 councillors, anybody else who wants to help.
I know, but when it comes to elections, look at the Brexit Party and UKIP, for example. The only way they really got any MPs was when sitting MPs defected to them. As soon as they stand in an election, they lose.
Yeah, no, you're quite right. But, you know, we're getting high-profile names now. Obviously, George is a great help to the party. But when you're getting, you know, former diplomats and obviously Chris Williamson coming over to us, we are getting some great socialists and great characters within the party. And I get what you mean about the electoral process in the UK. And, you know, I guess we're a proponent of PR. But even so, I think once you get that popular support, even with the public, I think that's insurmountable, right?
Yeah, you'll also make a dent in Labour, won't you? If you stand in the general election, you can remember we were hearing from George Galloway last week or week before that he wants to stand up to 50 candidates. Now, if he chooses where to stand, he can really annoy, and it's almost like stalk the Labour Party.
Well, we see, I think it was the comment earlier, Philippa said, you know, that the Labour Party are the block to the working class moving on. And that's what the way we see it. They've got to go. So where we can stand candidates that will where Labour have got those slim majorities, will stand candidates and take the votes off of them.
Well, it might not be too difficult in Bristol for the Labour Party to go, because our Labour mayor wasn't very popular at the referendum last year as to whether or not we were going to keep the mayor system. Bristol decided no, we didn't want it. And there's also been this, what many have been calling an unforced error, to do with Barton House, where the central government back in 2017 sent a letter to, this is just after Grenfell, sent a letter to Bristol City Council demanding that they go through several serious issues over the next year and send reports back saying whether or not their housing was safe. Well, Bristol City Council, for whatever reason, maybe because they keep changing their chief executive, didn't get round to doing this. This is one of the reasons that they say that they've evacuated Barton House, and that's now cost something like £3.5 million of all sorts of extra spending. Chatting to some of the Barton House residents this week by the bear pit, just hanging around smoking outside the Holiday Inn, they're saying, oh, well, the University of the West of England wants the building. So who knows? Apparently there's lots of other UE buildings around there. But this is what the actual residents say. I mean, that's just a rumour. I've no idea where they got that from. But it's quite feasible that Martin, I'll just ask you this briefly before we hear from the Barton House people. It's quite feasible that the council don't have the money to refurbish the place, but UWE do.
Well, it may be so. I mean, obviously, I've got no more information about this than you have.
Because the universities are almost driving the city at the moment. They're the ones with all the student loan money. They've got the foreign tuition fee money. They seem to be loaded where nobody else has got any money.
Well, they've got a bit of a problem because one of the things that the Tory government is doing is trying to prevent people bringing in spouses when they come to study in university here, and they won't give them visas to work when they've come.
Those spouses aren't paying tuition fees, are they?
No, but the point is that the universities puts the universities in potential financial crisis because they're no longer public institutions. Mm. They're businesses. It's bums on seats for them. And, of course, it's also to do with the British economy because your universities are the driving force of the service economy that you're talking about.
Anyway, representing Barton House at the council meeting on Tuesday is this thing called the Acorn Union, and I spoke to their communications guy, Wesley Bear, earlier this week because they had lots of questions to ask the mayor and the city council, particularly about what's been going on with Barton House, why it was evacuated, whether they will have anywhere to go at Christmas, will they be allowed to keep their dogs and pets and things, or will they have to be put down, destroyed, or left with friends, will they have to sleep in cars and this sort of thing. And Wesley takes up the story about what happened because they were all sitting there in the public gallery waiting to ask their questions, and they didn't get the chance.
I sat there myself in that public gallery, and also knowing that all questions are vetted before added to the agenda, and had to listen to Marvin Rees answer four questions at length, explaining that he couldn't answer the question. So we Acorn and the residents of Barton House are of the opinion that the council meeting yesterday was purposefully delayed in order to not get to our questions. When we were told that there was no time for any questions, the residents began shouting out their questions and asking for answers. It was at that point that majority of the council left the room, except the Greens. Most of the Greens stayed in protest with the residents of Barton House, agreeing that their questions should be answered. Then some members found Marvin Rees in the lobby. They started to ask him questions there. He was actually quite engaging with them in terms of acknowledging that they were there at that point. I remember seeing him giving one of the Acorn members, who's not even a resident of Barton House, a hug, you know. And then he made some snidey comments, which I'm not going to speak about because I don't want to be the one to bring that to light. But that caused some of the residents to become quite distressed with Marvin. And then I'm not quite sure how they kind of managed to escalate the situation into what it became, because essentially it was just members of Barton House trying to ask questions about their lives. You know, it's an emotive situation, and I think it needs to be accepted that these people are upset, and naturally upset human beings.
Look, we're heading towards Christmas now. These people have been left in the dark about whether they're even going to be allowed home at Christmas, or they'll be put up in a hotel somewhere and having to travel outside to get meals provided for them, and still, amazingly, having to pay rent for the homes that they're no longer allowed to occupy.
I find it atrocious. It literally gives me goose pimples, especially kind of being on the ground and knowing firsthand what the food is actually like and the environment they're in, you know, and like you say, not being able to go home but not having any correspondence about it whatsoever, just given a phone number to call, which nobody ever answers. Like, I don't understand how in 2023 this is happening to human beings. I genuinely don't understand how. You know, the food is substandard at best, and what food does come out isn't suitable for the children, you know, and these guys are paying rent and council tax for a property that is either unsafe or they've been kicked out, no fault evictions, with zero notice. It's atrocious. I don't know how the council can sit back and not speak to these residents after what they've put them through in these last 28 days.
Martin, this story is going around Bristol like wildfire. Lots of people talking about it. It's actually going around the country too. It's been hit the national headlines as well. It's not good for Labour in Bristol, is it? This is seen to be a mismanagement at best, incompetence at worst. Actually, it's some sort of malice telling them to phone numbers that there's no one there to answer.
Well, the obvious thing to point out is they shouldn't be paying rent. I mean, who made that decision? Absurd. And of course, the Labour Party in Bristol is staring down the barrel of a gun, but it's not from the Workers' Party, it's from the Green Party. Central Bristol West has got a very stonking big Labour majority, and I was a member of Bristol West Labour Party. I've been moved to Bristol East because they've just changed the boundary. And the Greens are going to win the May Council elections because that's what will happen. Bristol is a vanguard city. Yeah, so the Greens are you know, they've broken into the inner city wards, for example, yeah, where people with traditional Labour voters have decided they can punt on the Greens,
yeah,
and that's all good solid stuff. Of course, once they take over, they'll inherit the fact that there's no money for anything, and with £32 million over budget on special needs. I work for special needs kids, so I'm aware of that, and then they will get their check, but it will give them a good basis to take Bristol West at the general election, because that Bristol West was a safe Labour seat when it was held by
Valerie Davey, yeah,
and she didn't vote against the Iraq War. She didn't vote against it. She didn't vote for it. She abstained.
That's right.
And
yeah,
that wasn't good enough for the voters.
Well,
at
the time we were on photocopiers with the vote, what she voted, when it was, and dishing them out. And
yeah. Well, the thing is that cost of the seat.
People were putting them up in their
window. The Liberal Democrats, Steve Williams, then took the seat and held it. So the left wing vote in Bristol West, which was the highest Remain voting constituency in the country, yeah, but the left wing vote in Bristol West is plastic. It can go anywhere. Yeah, and you know, if you had a good Workers' Party candidate in one of the wards, you might be able to get them. I mean, I know that Jerry Hicks tried to stand in Lockleys. He didn't, because he was used to be Chief Stop Steward up at Rolls Royce. But anyway, that's the way I see it playing out. The Labour Party is, you know, when people like Zoe Williams are hardcore resigning, this is what Starmer's done. He's kind of demoralised and undermined.
But there's a human level to this story, Philip, isn't there? What they've been told is that even families, four, five, six people, they're being put into one room at the Holiday Inn, and with maybe an extra bed laid on by the hotel, and they're being put there indefinitely.
Well, this is what we're talking about in Gaza. I mean, you know, this is what's happening all around the world. I mean, there are demonstrations and protests about the cost of living in most countries around the world. You don't hear about it. We hear about France sometimes, those demonstrations, those protests. But I write a Substack called Geopolitics. It's not rocket science. And I look through all the protests about the cost of living crisis, people being very, very, you know, impoverished. Most of the countries in the world have huge demonstrations and protests going on right now. And it's called Protest Tracker. You should check it out, because this is the other side of the story. We know it's bad, but there is resistance, there is protest, and internationally we're not aware of it.
Well, that's the press's fault. We try and make people aware of it right here. This business, Barton House business, as a Bristolian yourself, Andy, what do you make of it?
Oh, it's just madness. I mean, look, we've struggled in this country for, well, council housing. I call it council housing. I don't think social housing cuts it anymore. We've got to do a council house building program, the likes have never seen before. And those residents in Barton House, you know, if there was that abundance of council houses, then we'd be able to find them.
But they can't, apparently. We had Paul Smith resign. Well, he said retire, but he really did resign because he couldn't get what he thought needed being done for housing for the Labour Party done here in Bristol. He was on the cabinet and he resigned. But I mean, if they can't even look after, literally, pay £10,000 for a survey the government have told them they've got to do on Barton House. And then they can't even look after it. I was chatting to them. They're saying, "Well, we've had it's been leaks through my ceiling for the last 2 years, and I've just given up now reporting the repair. They just don't bother looking after these places. I mean, how can we be building more if we can't even look after what we've got?"
Yeah, well, it's privatisation. All the kind of maintenance is outsourced. Nothing's in-house anymore. We don't do anything for ourselves anymore. The idea, you know, I remember as a kid, and I know I might look older, than, but I'm only 50 years old, but even I remember, you know, we lived in a council house because I was a single-parent family. But the council would come round and maintain it regularly, you know, and it was affordable rent. It was done on cost. So the actual price you were paying for rent was the cost it was to maintain the housing stock. And I don't think that's rocket science. But when you have, you know, private companies who do their, you know, grab their pound of flesh every time they change a light bulb, it just drives me insane.
Well, one of the things that I've noticed, I'm in social housing, is what they do is they come in and they sort of half fix it and then they have to come back again to
exactly.
So get paid,
exactly
per,
right.
paid per visit. Anyway, yes, as I said, we would get back to, I think we really do have to get back to Gaza is the big thing. At the moment, I was particularly disgusted last night. I always watch, for my sins, BBC Borrow Time, I call it, but it's supposed to be called Question Time, now run by somebody I think who's on attachment from Antiques Roadshow, seems to be in charge of the programme. I don't know how she managed to do that. There used to be a chap called Dimbleby who was from the Bullingdon Club, but my goodness, he didn't half know his political history, and he couldn't pull the wool over his eyes at all. If you started, no matter what party you were from, to start flannelling, he would pull you up straight away. But I'm afraid we don't get that from the Antiques Roadshow. No discussion whatsoever over the last 2 weeks about Gaza on this big BBC programme, and you just have to wonder why on earth that is. Do you want to just say something about Philippa? Because I know, you know, this is a big passion of yours. Looking at the geopolitics of Gaza, talk a little bit about the history of Zionism and how come the Zionists got their way back in the 1940s. I mean, this had been going for the best part of a century.
Well, that's a lot of questions.
It is, but just one, really.
You have 1 minute.
How come Zionism provoked... Yeah, well, this is a different show now. Just a minute. No, how did Zionism prevail?
Yeah. Well, that's because the British wanted it to prevail, particularly after World War One. And what happened during World War One is that they discovered that oil is the fuel that they needed to keep all the ships and the trains and the planes going. And so oil in the Middle East was huge. It became like a huge factor.
But hang on, Israel doesn't have oil. The Saudis do.
No, Israel doesn't have oil, but it has a port, and it's very centrally located on the Mediterranean. And one of the first things that actually happened once the British took over Palestine was that they created this port, Haifa, and they ran a oil pipeline to Kirkuk in Iraq. So that was a very important pipeline that they immediately started working on. So yes, and they made it's in the documents that they discussed this. It was called the Mesopotamian oil wells at the time. But they needed to have a base in the Middle East and with an eye open for oil and also to be close to the Suez Canal. India.
The British Empire was looking at this thinking, oh, gosh, there's these Zionists. They want to take over. But then they're also half looking at it again saying, hang on, this could be handy.
Yeah, and then in the end, they did take over the Palestine as a protectorate after the First World War. And then the Zionists decided to kick them out, and they wanted to have a Jewish homeland. And the British weren't, you know, they basically weren't sure. After a while, they began to see that there was so much Arab resistance against the encroaching Jewish Zionist colonization that the British began to see whether they weren't sure whether a Jewish homeland was really such a great idea. So they clung on to Palestine for a long time until finally the Stern Gang and these what we call terrorists, quote unquote, gangs. There were Zionist gangs, basically. Assassinated a few British officers, blew up a King David Hotel, and the British just gave up at that point and said, you can have it.
Okay, so what about at the UN? The UN voted for it after World War II, didn't it?
Yeah, actually, the Soviet Union was the first country to come on board with the idea because they also thought that it was a good idea to have some kind of friendly base in the Middle East.
But surely they must have known. I mean, this is maybe the beginnings of the Cold War here, but they would have known that this was mainly a British-American project. I mean, they would have been a little bit nervous, maybe.
No, well, I think they...
I suppose they'd still just... They've just, been allies, haven't they, really?
Yeah, they just want to keep their hand in, you know, and participate in some kind of way, yeah.
Okay, and so how do... I mean, you know, geopolitics now, how does this play into the... Because, I mean, things have changed a lot since then. The Chinese have been massive, aren't they? Russia has completely changed from the Soviet days, although, of course, it's still very powerful.
I think you're absolutely right about China. This is exactly what's happening. So China needs secure land and sea routes through which to transport oil and gas and from the Middle East, right? And so as part of its Belt and Road Initiative, it's signed a lot of strategic agreements with Egypt, the United Arab Emirates, Iran, Saudi Arabia, and Algeria. It's playing a very big role in terms of diplomacy. It managed to broker some kind of agreement between Iran and Saudi Arabia, which is absolutely amazing since these are two sworn enemies and they've been fighting it out in Yemen. And they're playing this big role now in the Middle East. And they've got this idea of how to have a sort of a trade corridor through the BRI initiatives, the Belt and Road initiatives, which they're funding. And the Americans are very upset about this. And they come up, just before this war actually began, they came up with this new alternative trade route that would be focused on Haifa, funnily enough, in Israel, right? Israel play a key role. And it's called the India Middle East European Economic Corridor. And they had actually announced this as a plan in September, just before the war broke out. And it's all under the umbrella of the Abraham Accords. So they had Saudi Arabia, they had, you know, some of these, you know, Gulf oil monarchies all lined up with this corridor.
Okay, so what's happening is, as these various fights have been breaking out over the last decade, particularly Yemen, as you were mentioning there, the Chinese are coming along and say, look, come on, you know, let's stop fighting and make some money.
Exactly. Really. I think that's what they're doing.
And they seem to be doing reasonably well. Is that a good way to portray it, Martin?
Yeah, that's a fairly good summary of where we're at. And things have changed because, I mean, as you can see, the UN Security Council vote last week, The US vetoed it, Britain abstained, and everybody else voted for a ceasefire, which is going to make it increasingly problematic for Starmer, not least because the Liberal Democrats have voted for a ceasefire, as have the SNP, as have the Irish government, the French government. Yeah, so he's out of step here. And, of course, he's hoist on his own petard with all of his anti-Semitism stuff, because it's exactly this that's turning into being his undoing, because he's just arrogant about it. They all are.
We had quotes
from Mandelson the other week, and he sees this as he's proving himself to the Americans and making, you know, this is what we're doing, and we're getting the Labour Party back, our Labour Party.
And you know what? Exactly the same has been going on today with the Israeli settlers. So you've had the European Union and the United States announcing that they will not be allowing any travel visas for Israeli settlers, especially now they've been being armed with these automatic weapons. And finally, today, the British went along with something which the EU and the Americans have already decided. So it is as if, you know, the UK is really, really behind the curve on this. But you mentioned this vote at the UN Security Council. This was a special vote. It was brought by Guterres. Let's have a listen to that now.
An unprecedented move by the UN Secretary General brought them here.
I fear the consequences could be devastating for the security of the entire region.
Antonio Guterres used his power to push for a UN Security Council vote on a ceasefire in Gaza. He got the vote, but not the result he was hoping for.
Against?
The United States vetoed the draft resolution, calling it rushed and incomplete.
Abstentions?
Abstentions.
Although the United States strongly supports a durable peace in which both Israelis and Palestinians can live in peace and security, we do not support this resolution's call for an unsustainable ceasefire that will only plant the seeds for the next war.
The United Kingdom abstained, saying the draft did not condemn atrocities Hamas committed on October 7th. The final vote tally, 13 for the resolution, 1 against, and 1 abstention. Palestinians.
This is a terrible day for the Security Council. Let me repeat, this is a terrible day for the Security Council. We reject this result and will continue resorting to every legitimate avenue to stop these abhorrent atrocities, including resuming the emergency session of the General Assembly.
The United Arab Emirates drafted the ceasefire call. Here's their representative to the UN speaking after the vote.
Regrettably, and in the face of untold misery, this council is unable to demand a humanitarian ceasefire. Let me be clear. Against the backdrop of the Secretary General's grave warnings, the appeals by humanitarian actors, the world's public opinion, this council grows isolated. It appears untethered from its own founding document. What is the message we are sending Palestinians if we cannot unite behind a call to halt the relentless bombardment of Gaza? Indeed, what is the message we are sending civilians across the world who may find themselves in similar situations?
So there's a message from the UAE, who, by the way, of course, were chairing COP as well this week, the climate conference. They seem to have been on the news all week, but there he is, who sponsored that motion at the UN Security Council, saying that the, you know, we're becoming detached here. Actually, the you know, the rest of the world is saying you've got to have a ceasefire, and the UN Security Council say no.
Well, the thing is, it wasn't the Security Council was there was a veto, that by the Americans. Basically.
Yeah, so, but that's the big one, isn't it? That's the one that makes the difference.
That's one that makes a difference. And the way the UN Security Council was set up was to have five major powers who were the victors of World War II have major power. Now, there are 10 other members that are countries that come on rotation onto the UN Security Council, but they don't have a veto. So you're putting a hell of a lot of power into five countries, and with one veto, that's it. So this just, all it does is shows how isolated the United States is, and it's really showing the United States up as the power it really is, which I'm glad, because all this time I think that we haven't understood exactly how the world public, in the West anyway, they haven't understood what a monster the United States has been for these many years in terms of how many millions of people it's killed in all sorts of wars. And now we're seeing it very, very clearly that they are for genocide.
Yeah, they spin it quite well. I mean, we had Henry Kissinger die just the other week. We were talking about the 3 million plus people he killed, and yet he got the Nobel Peace Prize.
Well, yeah, that's right. I mean, I think there's a lot of people who do understand that he is also a monster.
Okay, so Andy, what do you make of this? It's a big decision for them to veto it, but it means, in a way, what we've got is a UN that's topsy-turvy. So you've got the countries at the top in the General Assembly, which is all the whole world, can vote on something. But because the Security Council, which is the major powers, don't want it, or one of them vetoes it. But I suppose, in a way, this is practicality, isn't it? It's all very well for the whole world to want something, but the guys with the nuclear weapons, which most of these states are the ones that really decide these things. So, well, anyway, what do you make of that vote?
Well, what's the point of the UN anymore? If it isn't the world's police, what's the point of it? You know, I remember when I was serving, you know, because I'd done a few tours in former Yugoslavia, in the middle of the ocean, by the way. But, you know, you've seen the blue helmets go out and do kind of good things. But then, like I say, with a situation like this with the veto, what's the meaning? What's the meaning of it?
Philippa?
Well, I think the United Nations General Assembly has been called the conscience of the world. And that's clearly demonstrated that in this last unanimous, practically, vote for a ceasefire. And it's setting a moral standard and a standard of it's a symbolic standard, sure, and it's very frustrating that even in their resolutions and in the resolutions that I've heard out of the UN, that they're just calling for the ceasefire. When you call for a ceasefire, that doesn't make it binding. You have to demand a ceasefire, in which case you can bring in all sorts of mechanisms like sanctions, blockades, and so forth. So even so far, I was disappointed that the UN none of the UN bodies are demanding that we use actual sanctions and blockades. There should be a weapons blockade against Israel right now.
Yeah, so, I mean, many of us say the same, have similar thoughts to you. What's the point of this organisation? But I can tell you one great thing that they did in the Iraq War was they didn't vote for it. And so we ended up with an illegal war. So everywhere that that chap Tony Blair goes, everyone's pointing at him saying, you are a war criminal. And they're right. This isn't the way international war operates. So it hasn't been the case for places like Libya, etc., but for Iraq, it definitely was. Now, you mentioned Yugoslavia, and that was a place that Kevin Cahill, who's a former Sunday Times Rich List journalist and also an ex-army officer who served in Yemen himself, and I spoke to him this week about the murder of journalists over in Gaza, and he brought up Yugoslavia almost straight away.
Do you remember when the United Kingdom bombed Belgrade and hit the TV transmitter and hit the Chinese embassy? All sides do it. But the Israeli Defense Forces are refusing to let any journalists in at all, and Western journalists are not making enough, and the Western media is not saying, where are all our colleagues in Gaza? 65 of them are dead. The greatest toll of journalists ever in a two-month period.
Well, the Committee to Protect Journalists was set up exactly to look at things like this targeting of journalists in Gaza right now. They've investigated the Israeli Defense Forces and found that they have been deliberately targeting journalists, as you said. They have called for an investigation following reports on the war in Gaza by Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, Reuters and Agence France-Presse, suggesting the strike that killed Issam Abdallah and injured six others was a deliberate assault by the Israeli Defense Forces on civilians, which constitutes a war crime. Owen Jones, I mean, this is just one of those 70 or so journalists killed, plus also friends and family of those journalists. There does seem to be, we had also the crew of the Lebanese journalists a couple of weeks ago just filming on a hill, and they were actually killed by a high explosive tank round which is fired from a tank at them. This is deliberate. Do you think there'll be any kind of consequences? Because Owen Jones has written this thing in the Guardian last week saying that he cannot understand why there's not more of an outcry from the newspapers.
Well, look at our newspapers here. The Mail, Express and the Telegraph are all owned by tax-dodging proprietors. And the Times, Sunday Times and the Sun. The owners are dishonest people. They don't pay their taxes. So, you know, what do you expect of the news organizations? They're all pulling their punches. I feel it very strongly, that unwillingness to challenge the Israelis and say, where are all our colleagues? Why are they all dead? And why are all their families dead with them? If you think what the targeting parameter is, did you work for the local authority? And the Israelis are targeting anybody who did. So everybody, you know, the chap who emptied the dustbin worked for Hamas. They were the local authority. So he's a target, and he's probably dead now. Anybody who was working for the local authority in Gaza is almost certainly dead by now. This was targeted. And the thing about targeting the journalists is the Israeli government controls that peculiar software that can trace journalists. So you're a journalist in Gaza, and you switch on your mobile, you're probably dead. The Israelis can pick it up instantly.
Well, this discussion about the use of technology there, but also this whole idea of getting rid of the witnesses, Philippa, this is, I'm not saying it's unprecedented, because it's not, it's happened before, but never surely to this degree.
And this is where we have to be very aware of alternative news media, and I can make some suggestions here on what to follow.
Yes, okay. Yeah, please do.
So the Electronic Intifada, the Palestine Chronicle, Al Jazeera, of course, the Grey Zone with Max Blumenthal, and Breaking the Silence, which is a fantastic organization of former Israeli soldiers who are basically come out for peace and talking about their experiences. But the Electronic Intifada is and the Palestine Chronicle, if you just follow those two, you're going to get the picture of exactly what's going on there.
But the trouble is, and I'm sure Kevin would say this too, is if you don't have the journalists actually there, I mean, for example, there was a Owen Jones talked about a Sky team that were in Gaza. They witnessed during the ceasefire the Israeli soldiers shooting into crowds of civilians. Now, if those journalists weren't there, that would, I mean, none of these Electronic Intifada couldn't even report it. Especially when their internet is down in Gaza. This sort of, there are an enormous amount of pressures on actually witnessing what's happening, is what I'm trying to say.
No, that's true. I mean, the Palestine Chronicle does a lot of reporting of what Hamas says. So if you want to get Hamas's view, you would go to the Palestine Chronicle.
Is Hamas a terrorist organization?
Well, I don't like the term terrorist because it means so many things to people, and there's actually no consensus of opinion about what a terrorist is under international law.
Is an AI program a terrorist if it's actually targeting and coordinating the killing of people, which we've heard has been going on in Gaza, but certainly has been happening in Ukraine? It's apparently the first time it happened was in Libya, so you've got a bit of software basically choosing targets and sending drones to kill them.
Well,
I mean,
those are war crimes.
Is that a terrorist?
No, those are war crimes,
right.
And we've got a whole legal structure to deal with war crimes. There isn't any agreed upon legal structure under international law to deal with terrorism. So I prefer to talk about war crimes. But anyway, you asked about Hamas and which I prefer to call the Islamic Resistance Movement. So basically, a lot of people aren't aware of this, but the right to resist was upheld. The right to resist of the Palestinian people was upheld in 2004 by the International Court of Justice. And this was an opinion it gave when Palestinian movement went to the ICJ to ask for an opinion, actually via the General Assembly.
International Court of Justice.
Yes, the
Where's
International
that,
Court.
In
That's in The Hague.
Right,
yeah.
Not to be confused with the International Criminal Court.
Not to be confused
with
them.
Which almost always seems to prosecute black African leaders
exactly.
for some reason.
Yeah, no, this is very different.
Yep.
And they've come out, they've done a lot of work in terms of being very critical of the United States. So I would prefer to go to the ICJ, not the ICC. But in any case, so the ICJ, the International Court of Justice, so their opinion was when the Palestinian movement went to get an opinion on the wall that was being constructed in the West Bank, saying that it was a violation of human rights. Basically, its opinion was that Israel cannot claim the right of self-defense against a threat that emanates from the territory it occupies.
Right.
Okay, so what happened on October the 8th was a threat from the territory... a threat from the territory that it occupies. So an analogy of that is that say you hit me, right? And then I hit you back. And then you say, oh my God, I had the right to self-defense because you hit me. But you were the initial aggressor, right? So Israel is the initial aggressor. It has occupied land. And there's every Hamas, and the Palestinian people have every right to resist.
Here's a really crucial question then. What about this line, the Gaza line, around Gaza? Are the Israelis officially occupying land outside that, or just the land inside that? Because, I mean, we've had lots of wars over the years, and I'm not sure about UN resolutions and what they say. The current Israel has a legal right to occupy.
Who says that?
Well, what I'm asking is, where is the current legal boundary of Israel? Is it just on the border of Gaza, or is it elsewhere? Because, I mean, we've seen since the Israelis were given their right to territory in 1948 that they've been pushing and pushing through the years to actually expand that. So I wonder, I mean, if you're Hamas attacking into just outside Gaza, is that land considered to be occupied by Israel too?
Yeah, well, the thing is that Israel has never said what its borders are. It's one of its little tricks.
Surely the UN can. We can. We can tell, say, look, this is Martin, do you want to come in here?
Yeah, but...
Well, I mean, this is the nub of the matter.
It is, isn't it?
I mean, the 1948, they were given a state in 1948, which is much smaller than what they've got now, but is far bigger than they deserved in terms of the population that they had at the time. But they never accepted that from the get-go. And although it was recognised by the United States and the Soviet Union, lots of the local countries didn't accept it, and the Palestinians weren't even consulted. So they're under no obligation to accept that. I think what's happened now, as time's gone on, is that the 67 border, which is when they pushed back into what is now Gaza, that was taken by war in 67, as was Jerusalem. Now, in the original resolution of 1948, they weren't supposed to have Jerusalem at all. They're not supposed to be there. And I was an aid worker in Bosnia during the 1990s, when you were in the Navy flying overhead. And, of course, in actual fact, all of this stuff comes to a head at some point.
Was it a flying ship?
Oh, no, it was an aircraft carrier.
Oh, okay.
Well, I think I talked to your boss at one stage. You used to be in chief of it. That was in Bristol. But the point is that we went to war with Serbia because we said that Kosovo, which had been an autonomous region within Serbia, as decided by Tito, just as the Ukraine that we're now fighting over was actually decided by Lenin and Stalin. They decided what those borders would be in the Ukraine. And they're not set in stone, any of these borders. And, of course, the Israelis continuously push over the gain line. That's the in their
sure,
strategy
they are,
all along.
They are set in stone in international law.
No, we went to war with Serbia.
Just want to say that there is the Resolution 242 that the United Nations has passed, which basically says that the pre-1967 borders are one of the borders. But Hamas doesn't agree with that because the whole of Israel is occupied land as far as they're concerned.
That's right. Right.
Now, what Israel's done, and I just want to make this point, is that they are what I call an occupation denier. You know, we have Holocaust deniers. They actually deny that they are occupying those lands. Yeah. So their view is that that this is basically separate territory, that the West Bank and the Gaza are separate territories, and that they have the right to defend themselves against any attacks from these separate territories.
Okay, so the key question I'm coming to is, does Israel have the right to self-defense when Hamas attacks out of Gaza?
No, this is the point of the 2004 International Court of Justice opinion. It's a legal opinion. It's the only opinion that we have, and it's the highest court in the world. You can't get any higher than the ICJ in terms of speaking about international law. And they said specifically that this is when you occupy a land and you are the aggressor, the aggressor does not have the right of self-defense when they're being attacked by the occupied from anywhere from within and emanating from the occupied territory.
What we're hearing a lot about now is how we're going to see the Hamas eliminated, this kind of thing. Do the Palestinians have a right of self-defense against Israel?
Oh, absolutely, yes. I mean, they're an occupied territory. They are the victims of U.S. aggression, and they absolutely have the right of self-defense. It's the same how when Germany occupied France in World War II, nobody questioned the French resistance and saying, oh, they don't have a right, that Germany had a right of self-defense against the French resistance, did they?
No, I don't think they did.
Germans did.
Maybe
the Germans did.
Yeah, Joseph Goebbels. Right. Joseph Goebbels had it on a tape loop, and it was going out on Radio Luxembourg for months on end. So what about Israel saying it wants the two-state solution. Palestinian leaders have turned down Israel's offer of territory.
Yeah, no, Israel has successfully bypassed the two-state solution. It just went along with it, you know, at some point. But really, it had no interest. It's had no interest for a long time. It's been playing off Hamas against Fatah. You know, it's actually Netanyahu has a policy of keeping Fatah and Hamas in power. This is all now proven. This is two presidents.
So why? I mean, you've got this whole business from the 1980s with Yasser Arafat. I seem to remember he was actually poisoned by the Israelis with polonium in his toothpaste, and they wanted to get rid of Arafat and the Palestine Liberation Organization, which when I was growing up, you know, these were the terrorist guys. We would see the Palestinians, you know, doing this and that around the world, hijacking planes and this sort of thing. But they were out the window and Hamas has taken over, which is this Islamist organization, supposedly. So what's behind all that?
Right, well, I'm just going to quote from Ehud Olmert, who was prime minister from 2006 to 2009. He had he was interviewed in October, last October, by the UK Daily Telegraph. Hardly anybody picked up on this, but I just want to tell you what he said. He said, when Netanyahu took over from me in 2009, he said his first priority was to destroy Hamas. And actually what he did was the opposite. He tried to destroy the Palestinian president, Mahmoud Abbas, and the Palestinian Authority, because that would have required political concessions from Israel. And he moved to promote Hamas because they never would be partners for negotiations, so you could kick them. I mean, those are his words, but basically he's saying he wouldn't negotiate with Hamas because he can label them as terrorists. So it's handy to have terrorists in power so that, I don't negotiate with terrorists. And then there was a stalemate for a very long time.
You know, in a weird way, this sort of fits in with a lot of what we've seen since 9/11, Martin, doesn't it? With this being framed as a religious conflict now between Jews and Muslims, whereas before it wasn't, because Arafat was this secular guy and certainly, you know, embraced different all religions and none kind of thing, which is actually what was a successful formula in the Holy Land before 1948, seemed to work rather well. So anyway, what do you make of this swap over to Hamas and how it maybe links in with some of these other Islamist groups, these kind of weaponized religious Muslim armed groups?
Well, Hamas was originally created by the Israeli intelligence services as a mechanism to undermine the secular leftists of Fatah. So they definitely were created by them. I see Hamas as started off as that, and until very recently, Netanyahu made a speech to Likudnik Knesset members saying, you know, we're giving money to Hamas because we want to help them to undermine Palestinian unity. And of course, Hamas won the Palestinian election in 2006, both in the West Bank and in Gaza. And of course, there's lots of people in refugee camps in Jordan and Lebanon and so on. They don't get any say in anything. They're just written out of history. And that's the perception of it. Hamas, to my mind, is modelled on the Irgun. It's exactly like that. It's been modelled on those Jewish terrorist organisations. It's got a very, very tough terrorist wing, but they go to Moscow. They talk to everybody. Everybody is talking to them. The Israelis are talking to them via the Qataris because they've got to. At the same time, as pretending that they're going to destroy them. Militarily, it doesn't look as if they are. They've killed quite a few of them, but they're very well dug in Gaza. They're killing lots of civilians, lots of journalists, but not so many Hamas fighters. And in actual fact, I'm not sure they've got the bottle to go in there and get them, because it'll be a battle like we've seen on the Eastern Front with thousands and thousands of casualties. And I'm not sure they've really got the stomach for it. But of course, what's also happening is people asking the question, the big question, why is Israel there at all? The two-state solution, they have deliberately smashed it. Now, what the right wing in Israel got to understand is when you do that, we're not going back to the borders of 67 when this is settled, possibly by the Russian army coming into Golan. Can you think about that? That can happen. Yeah? The Russian Air Force are in Syria. They're there. And the Golan Heights have been annexed by Israel, but it's not been. There was another vote in the UN Security General Assembly, virtually unanimous. Nobody, apart from the British and the Americans, accept that Golan is part of Syria.
I think it's part of Israel. Somebody that won't like that if the Russians do go into the Golan Heights is Rupert Murdoch, because of his oil concession with Jacob Rothschild. They got an oil concession about 2016 or 2017, awarded by the Israelis into land that they don't actually own. So this is, I mean, I think it's fascinating looking at the implications of why the press take the attitude they do. Quite clearly, Rupert Murdoch's got quite a big financial stake in all this. But look, we can't keep talking about how terrible the Israelis are without actually hearing from the man himself. And this is a speech by Benjamin Netanyahu, really only, I think, it's about 2 weeks after this conflict started. But it's where he starts to stray into talking about this as a kind of holy war, and how when they're fighting the Palestinians, the Israeli soldiers are fighting the Amalekites from the Old Testament.
We have a wonderful army. We have exceptional soldiers, real heroes, both Jews and non-Jews, secular and religious, from the left wing, from the right wing. They are all united and filled with a combat spirit that I've never seen before. They are willing to fight full force against an enemy that there is no other enemy as cruel as it is. They want to retaliate for the horrific acts that these people conducted against our children, parents, sisters, brothers, and friends. They are committed to completely eliminate this evil from the world for our existence, and let me add, for the benefit of all of humanity, the entire people and all of Israeli leadership. We all embrace them and believe them. You must remember what Amalek has done to you, says our Holy Bible. And we do remember, and we are fighting. Our brave troops and combatants who are now in Gaza or around Gaza and in all other regions in Israel are joining this chain of Jewish heroes, a chain that has started 3,000 years ago from Joshua ben Nun until the heroes of 1948, the Six-Day War, the 73 October War, and all other wars in this country. Our hero troops, they have one supreme main goal: to completely defeat the murderous enemy and to guarantee our existence in this country. We've always said, never again. Never again is now.
Netanyahu speaking a couple of weeks ago. Also, I think it's interesting, Philippa, him using this term never again. Never again is now. Now, this is something that was used to describe the Holocaust, wasn't it, after World War II?
Oh, it's all part of the propaganda. They want to weaponize the Holocaust, which I find absolutely abhorrent, that they're using the Holocaust as a justification for genocide. I mean, it's abhorrent. Yeah.
I suppose he's thinking, well, butter wouldn't melt in his mouth. He's coming out. But what about this biblical stuff from the book of Samuel, the Amalekites? He's saying that essentially that it's the same sort of struggle that was going on with the Jewish people when Moses brought them out of captivity.
You know, if you start quoting a 2,000-year-old text as your claim for, to commit genocide and even to claim land, which is what Israel is based on, it's based on a 2,000-year-old anonymous text. That's fundamentalism. I mean, that's what we call fundamentalism. So yeah, so it's desperate. He's resorting to myths. We don't even know half of that happened. You know, this is not. It's shrouded in the ancient, well, ancient history.
What do you make then of this? The attempts to turn it into a religious conflict.
Well, that's been the whole basis of Israel, isn't it? It's taking over the symbolism of Judaism, the Star of David, and, you know, all this focus on the Bible, and taking it over when, in fact, it's a nationalist, I think, fascist state that's adopting the symbolism of a religion. And there are many Jews who are very upset about this, including a lot of Orthodox Jewish sects who have come out to demonstrate and basically saying that we are a religion. We are not a political party. We are a religion, and the two are completely separate. So what Netanyahu is doing is taking over religious symbolism, religious beliefs, and turning it into a political movement. And that's what Zionism is.
I mean, if you go and have a look at the Amalekites in the Old Testament, they are Canaanite faith. Many of these Canaanite faiths, and I'm not sure whether the Amalekites did, actually did practice child sacrifice. And yet what's going on is we're now seeing the number of children in Gaza being killed, running up to nearly 8,000 children killed in Gaza. Now, that is not children being sacrificed by Amalekites. It's being sacrificed by the IDF.
Yes, but this is something that America's been doing for a long time. If you look at what's happened in Iraq, for example, if you look at the sanctions against Iraq, which I've been very researched in the 90s, 500,000 children died from the sanctions. So this is an imperial project. Anywhere you get superpowers, powers that are military superior, you will get the sacrifice of children and women. And this is not just Israel. This is, we need to look at the United States, what it has done over the years.
Yeah, and the Brits. So obviously, we have an amazing role. I mean, we were looking into this when this first started, looking at Allenby's campaign in World War One, because in 1917, there was this thing called the Battle of Gaza, which was a big push, and as the Turkish Ottoman Empire was pushed out of Gaza, so the Balfour Declaration was published in the Times at the end of that week. Mm. And if you go on another year, the First World War was actually the amnesty with the ceasefire was signed with the Turks the week after the Battle of Megiddo, which was pushing the Turks out of northern Palestine. So it seems to, I'm just looking back at this and thinking, well, actually, quite a lot of the First World War may have been a distraction going on in Europe, while this was the main object, is just pushing the Ottomans out so the British could take control.
Oh, yeah, I agree with you completely. And this is something that I think Lenin noted as well, you know, that this war, you know, was about, it's a colonial war. And it had to very much to do with the what they call the Mesopotamian oil wells. And that's, yeah, I agree.
Yeah, oil's a big part of it. There is oil in Gaza too, apparently.
Yeah, well, there's gas fields for sure that we know are offshore gas fields that basically the Israel has managed to take over in some kind of way. That it was the gas fields offshore of Gaza was basically were granted to the Palestinian Authority under the Oslo Accords of 1995, and then in 2008 Israel declared sovereignty over the Gaza Marine Territory, and suddenly the gas fields were theirs. It's complete theft of Gaza's gas fields. They're not huge, but they are, you know, substantive, and they would have been good to you know, for trade and for giving you know, relief to the Palestinian people.
Well, I'd like to see Extinction Rebellion over there protesting against the potential exploitation of these new gas fields. we could see that as well. Anyway, look, just moving towards the end of our discussion about Gaza, the great hope, of course, for many people on the left is that Sir Keir Starmer will do something to challenge the apparent consensus in Parliament about this. But anyway, so he gave a speech this week, which was setting out his agenda, what he called his agenda for change. It had very little to do with, much to do with foreign policy. And so let's have a listen now to Starmer and see if there's any hope here for something to change things for the better, whether it's foreign policy or domestic policy.
Yes, Brexit was a vote for lower immigration. Of course it was. But it was also a vote for that idea that we need to renew, that hard work should be rewarded with a wage people can live on. And for the Tories, that's the rub. 7 years they've had to make Brexit work. But every time they run up against a choice between raising skills and working conditions or issuing more visas, they choose the higher migration option. And it's not an accident. It's who they are. They're not interested in earning your vote. They feel entitled to it. They think economic strength comes from driving down the terms and conditions of the British people. And they won't change. Five prime ministers. They've all believed it. So if you voted for Brexit 7 years ago, if you voted for the Conservatives 4 years ago, and you're still waiting for the change you demanded, if you believe working people deserve a new foundation of security, with rising home ownership driven by a reformed planning system, a new national wealth fund investing in the jobs of the future, cleaner bills guaranteed by clean British energy, and technical excellence colleges training our kids in the skills we need, if you think work should pay fairly, that practices like zero-hour contracts and fire or rehire should be scrapped, and that we need a solution for sectors like care that isn't just exploiting immigrants on low pay. If, in short, you want lower migration and higher wages, or even if you just want a government committed to economic stability, the rule of law, good public services, restoring Britain's standing, making family life more secure, and putting the country first, then I say again, this is what a changed Labour Party will deliver. You won't get it from a Tory fifth term. Only a change of government can bring change to our country. So join us on this mission, because whether you are a Conservative who is thinking of voting Labour for the first time, or a Conservative who has occasionally trusted us before, whether you've always voted Labour or have absolutely no intention of voting Labour, we will serve you. But I also say this, and I mean it, look around your country. We need you. Britain must come together. I believe in this country. I believe in its spirit. I believe in its people, in its businesses, in its communities. But most of all, I believe that if the British people see respect and service in their politics, then they will commit to the national mission of renewal. So if we are privileged enough to win the next election, if we earn your trust, we will set the direction, we will give Britain hope, we'll walk together towards national renewal with a new mission to get Britain building again, take back our streets, switch on great British energy, get the NHS back on its feet and tear down the barriers to opportunity. A Britain where hard work is rewarded, aspiration is backed, communities have more control, politics serves your interests, and where together we can say, in a cry of defiance to those who write our country off, Britain can, Britain must, Britain will get its future back. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you.
So that's Sir Keir Starmer there, leader of Britain's opposition. Labour Party, thank you very much. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Let's start with you, Andy. This is a party you're up against. You're going to be at the next general election. The trouble is, of course, they've got massive resources. What have you got to say to what his agenda for change there?
Yeah, well, I'd love to see it, but that bloke can't even lie in bed straight. I can't remember a time, you know, he's reneged on so many promises and backtracked on so many pledges that I've forgotten now and I've given up on listening to him anymore. And I also remember the Warwick Agreement, you know. The Warwick Agreement, you know, remember the days of the awkward squad where the trade union leaders were taken to task the Labour Party to make sure they deliver for working people. Do you remember that? Well, that was under Blair's years, and I think there was about 12 or 14 pledges then. Only one of them was delivered. I mean, their kind of adoption of capitalist economics won't deliver any social change, and not meaningful social change. You know, and, you know, we say in the Workers' Party that the economics has got to go with it. We need common sense socialism, the public ownership of those things that we need to bloody survive. a roof over our head, food on the table, cheap energy, you know, meaningful jobs, a reinvention of the economy, you know, outside of Europe.
One of the things that strikes me, I don't know if the Workers' Party's got any policies on this, is housing. This seems to be one of the main drivers of this cost of living crisis, where people, whether it's rent or mortgages or whatever it is, the price of housing is taking a bigger and bigger slice of people's annual income, or weekly or monthly.
Yeah, well, you've got, I forget which generation I am at the moment. I think I'm, what am I, Z or something? I don't know. But, the millennials, I know they're a thing. You know, we'll never get a house. You know, they'll never be able to afford to get a deposit to get a house because the wages don't cut it anymore. The house prices have gone through the roof because there's no housing stock. What we need is those affordable homes, affordable rents. I mean, thousands of them build them. You know, that not only creates, growth for jobs for people building the houses, but actually we'll have affordable houses. The market will stabilise.
2024, this is going to be a big year for us. And I believe that we will make significant progress. And my goodness, we need it. Not just for these international reasons, not at all. As a matter of fact, we wish that things were different and that we could concentrate on the big crisis in which our people are now sunk. This is the worst state that we've been in since 1940 and 41. And there's no Churchill, there's no Bevin to step forward, and Attlee, others. There's no one who can step forward and rescue our country, which is tossing like a cork on the ocean waves, leaderless, rudderless, sinking. That's the country we now live in. I was listening very closely to what both Andy and Chris said, and remembering about the person who asked me yesterday to define working class. It was clear from the nature of the tone of the question that this person believed there was no such thing anymore. But let me invite you to look around you. Everything you see in this room and everything you see outside and everything you have and use when you go back home was made by a worker. None of it came like a puff of magical smoke. Someone made it. Someone mined it. Someone extracted it. Someone manufactured it. Someone packaged it. Someone transported it. Someone sold it. All of these tasks were carried out by workers. Our problem is, most of them were carried out by workers who worked for less in other countries because our capitalists exported our jobs that we had done, that our fathers and mothers had done, exported them. I once had a debate against one of Trump's men, Bannon. Steve Bannon. He said the Chinese have stolen our lunch. I said it was the American capitalists that stole your lunch. It was them that relocated their factories in China, where the workers worked for less than the American workers worked. Why blame the Chinese? Blame your own ruling class and demand the American jobs are brought back to America to be done by Americans. And that's what we need to. That's the spirit that we need to reconnect with. Almost all of us have got cars. Why aren't we building our own cars, our own buses, our own trucks, our own motorbikes, our own railway carriages, rolling stock? Now that we're out of the European Union, we are entirely free to invest in our own industries, to procure only from our own industries. We can tell the ambulance service, you're only going to buy British ambulances. We can tell the railway companies, you're only going to buy British rolling stock. But that requires us to have the manufacturing capacity to make these things. And we must rediscover that. Because there's no future for us as a service economy. We've seen the weather outside. How many tourists do you think we can attract? How many of us can make a living serving ice cream to foreign visitors? Our only basis of national salvation is to rediscover our industrial past, rediscover our industrial greatness.
So with the railways, I know George Galloway was talking about renationalising the railways. Do you think that, well, you know, would that, is that realistic? It's going to be very expensive, surely.
No, I mean, the contracts that the train operating companies on at the moment, they have a finite end, you know, they will end. And when they do, you take it into public ownership. There's no need for paying back any money or bonuses to any fat cats. Just take it back into public ownership. I mean, it's more difficult than that, of course, because there's so many layers in that you've got to unravel in the privatised sector. But it can be done, and it's very popular and will be done.
And it's actually cheaper, folks, as we heard earlier on. £2 billion a year is going from the government into these railways. Martin, what do you make of Keir Starmer's agenda for change? We heard spelt out a bit of there. I'll put a link up, by the way, on our show page to the full interview at thisweek.org.uk. It's not an interview. It's not me interviewing him. It's him giving a speech and a bit of a Q&A afterwards. But what do you make of it?
Well, let's just concentrate on the economic policy. Rachel Reeves, the shadow chancellor, has made it clear that they're not going to challenge any of the basic structures of that need to be challenged. In 2008, the global banking system collapsed, and the commanding heights of the economy were handed over to government with a dummy in its mouth. At that point, that's when the Labour Party, they should have seen that coming. They were in government at the time. They should have seen that coming. Gordon Brown had a background in political economy. He should have seen that coming a mile off. And when it happened, he did manage to play a pretty good sort of let's keep up with the thing game. But at the same time, once you've nationalised things, they then immediately said, well, we've got to put them back into the private sector. Yes, so why? Why? You've nationalised them. Keep them. Yeah. Then you can do what you want. And it could have been just a one quick manoeuvre, like a judo throw.
Yeah, yeah.
But we didn't do it. And, of course, what subsequently happened is we're now back to this, we can afford a war in the Ukraine. We can afford, to waste years and years and years arguing about Brexit, whatever side you're on about it. Yeah. It's largely an irrelevance to the reality of the global economy. And as I mentioned earlier, the Americans just blew up the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which just shafts the German economy, which is an absolutely integral part of our economy. Mm-hmm. Yeah? And that's the world we're in. And Rachel Reeves just doesn't get it, because she just thinks, well, we've just got to tweak at the edges here. We're going to have a global financial collapse and a world war. Oh, yeah. It's not going to be enough, is it? You're going to have to take a more radical attitude. But, of course, what the hope is that as all this pressure builds up, the obvious things to do will have to be done. Industries will go bust, like the water industry will go completely bust. They'll have to take it over because there's nothing else to be done with it.
Yeah, this seems to be happening increasingly with these privatised industries as they can't make money. It's almost impossible. You know what's happening is they cannot collect the money. So there are all sorts of bills that people cannot pay, but they can't pay them. And so they're now saying with the energy price cap, I just heard this earlier on, they're going to have to put it up this winter because the energy companies are saying, well, we've got loads and loads of people that can't pay their bills. So the ones that can, we're going to have to put them up. Anyway, what do you make of Starmer as a sort of man to take us into the future? This agenda for change, he calls it.
No, I don't think much of it. And that's all I got to say about that.
Okay. Do you want to just remind us of your, is it a Substack you say you've got?
Yeah, it's called Geopolitics. It's not rocket science. And I just want to mention also, there's a left-leaning newspaper in Israel that is called Haaretz.
Oh, yeah, we like that, yeah.
It's okay, because right now they're unraveling the narrative of what happened on October 7th.
Wow.
It turns out there wasn't, 1,200 Israeli civilians killed, that the Israelis themselves, the IDF, killed a lot of them using tanks. And if you saw the incinerated bodies in the houses, you know that that's not done by a gun. It's done by missiles from a tank or from a helicopter. I don't know if you remember seeing some of those incinerated bodies. So when I saw that, I thought that wasn't done by somebody with an, can't remember what those rifles are called. It was done by a missile. So that's the incinerated body story. So that's coming up in Haaretz. And also Haaretz is unraveling the whole question about how many Israeli troops are actually dying. And they've gone around the hospitals and their figure is way higher than what the IDF is admitting to.
I mean, one of the things we haven't even touched on is the families of the hostages, because, I mean, they've been kicking up a hell of a fuss saying, well, hang on a minute, don't bomb Gaza. Our hostage families are there. And yet Netanyahu is saying, well, we're going to get all the hostages back by bombing Gaza and by eliminating Hamas.
Exactly.
So what about those families? I mean, have they gotten, are you not listening to them or what?
No, they're very, very angry and upset, and it's understandable. I mean, they're probably underground as well. The hostages are underground in those incredible tunnels, which are a feat of engineering. But they're being pounded. They can hear the bombs going, and they must be thinking, this is, my country is bombing me.
Where do you think it's heading?
I keep thinking that there's going to be some kind of external state coalition coming in to sort this out if it continues like this. So I hate predictions. I don't think people who are analysts should ever predict, because it's going to undermine their credibility when they're wrong.
Well, a lot of people are nervous because the Israelis have nuclear weapons, aren't they?
Yeah, and they've got the Samson option. We've heard all about that.
Do you want to tell us about that?
Well, basically, it's saying that that Israel will kill everybody and anybody to get their way, and that's including their own people. And I think we saw that in this, just a sort of a microcosm of that, in the what happened on October 7th, because they did kill their own people indiscriminately. I mean, what they could have done is have some kind of, police action or some kind of, pursue it as more of like a crime rather than a war, and bring in the IDF and all of that and then start negotiations right away. They chose not to do that. They chose to kill their own citizens because they couldn't figure out who was Hamas and who were the Israelis. So I think they've got that mindset. They're crazy. They are psychopaths.
Well, some have compared the Netanyahu, this far-right Greater Israel bloc, to the Nazis. Would you do that as a Jewish person?
Well, Nazis is, to me, a Nazi is anyone who's a psychopath in charge of a very big organization that's a military organization. So to me, a Nazi has a particular meaning in Germany. But to me, a Nazi in the more generic sense are these psychopaths who are in charge of our world right now. Now, for example, the United States. It's got a psychopath mentality that is willing to sacrifice and kill millions of people. I mean, Noam Chomsky has it that since World War II, the U.S. has been engaged in wars practically every year and has ended up killing 20 million people since World War II. That's Noam Chomsky said that. He's added up the figures. So that's what we're talking about, pure evil, pure psychopathic evil. I don't like, saying it's Nazi or what. These are crazy people and they're in charge of the world. That's worrying.
I suppose they're in a sort of same situation as Oliver Cromwell was, if I can trivialise it in that way, because he knew after he'd won the English Civil War that he had to get rid of the king, he had to kill the king. Otherwise the king would have come back and gotten him. And in the same way, he seems to be now understanding that unless he turns into some sort of dictator, that he's going to end up, for all these fraud charges and whatever, he's going to end up in jail. He doesn't want that, does he?
No, that's true. He's up for himself. It's okay.
Just remind us of your Substack once more.
Yeah, sorry. It's called Geopolitics, It's Not Rocket Science.
Okay, and Andy, your party is, you could just
The Working
sum
Party
up for
of
us.
Great Britain. And I say we're building. We're getting 50 members a week joining us, so we're really positive and buoyant. We're developing a manifesto now that was on the back of a conference that we had the other week, and that's member led. And I'm really optimistic about it. And the cause we're pushing is that common sense socialism, the fact that actually everybody just wants to live in peace, have food, a roof over their head, the basics in life that they're provided for and they're cheap, and a meaningful job for the love of God. We recognise that the economy needs to be reorganised, restructured, and all the things that, Keir mentioned some of them, but I don't believe them coming out of his mouth.
No.
And deliver those. Yeah.
Well, it shouldn't be rocket science. You just run it with a bit of care and attention and honesty towards the people that you're governing, rather than try and govern as if these people are your slaves somehow. But anyway, so Philip Winkler and Andy Hudd, thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, it's a pleasure, mate.
Thanks for having us.
Babylon, no kingdom fall down. Jah kingdom come.
Ooh, yeah.
Babylon, no kingdom fall down.
Jah kingdom come, I say.
Babylon, no kingdom fall down.
Ooh, yeah. Woe be unto all you false preachers.
Designated zones, no private land, no
5% of us have gone. All the ones who saw it coming were silenced or ignored. Bit by bit they stole from us the life we had before. So at Christmas time 2030, those that didn't make it through. GM foods, the censorship of different views, and it all began with the climate scare and the policies that targeted the youth. Oh, and if you don't believe it, there's something you should know. The Club of Rome.
Hey boy, just start the bass guitar, no man. Richie, play the bass.
Yeah.
Well, that's a little bit of reggae to start with, in honour of Kaylin Selassie. We had a couple of weeks ago from the Bristol Rasta community, and also, of course, because it's a terrific tune, the Twinkle Brothers, Jar Kingdom Come from 1980. And then we heard Martin Noakes. He did the 9/11 Building 7 song, and also the excellent, what's the title of it? Crikey, it was the lockdown song, the best of all the lockdown songs by far, which was a great little dance tune. Was also put together by Martin, and that song was called Christmas 2030. He produced that last year. In fact, you can hear the interview where he talks about that song a little bit from last year's shows. And so, GF 2022. And finally there, that was from Newport Gwent. That's Dub War and a song called Over Now. And I think very appropriately saying end the past and change the future. Yes, we will end the past and change the future. We will do that, absolutely, as they have asked us to do. Anyway, welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. We're going to start, though, Martin, kind of resuming this thing about foreign policy, but just start off with MI6, as we like to do on this programme. Sir Richard Dearlove's gorgeous face popped up on the TV this week talking about the Russians. Well, they will, of course, impact UK and US elections.
We're now joined by Sir Richard Dearlove, the former head of the Secret Intelligence Service, himself a hacking target. Thank you for being with us. How concerned are you by this news?
Well, I've been concerned about it for a long period of time, and I think it's very good that the government have decided to publicise this, because, you know, it does heighten the vigilance of individuals and organisations, the seriousness of the threat and the extent, and the very broad extent of Russian activity. So, yeah, it's good that they're drawing attention to it, and it's been going on for a long period of time already.
So what kind of information do you think they are trying to get?
Well, look, we're in a situation of grey warfare with Russia because of Ukraine. And as far as the Russians are concerned, the information world is part of the battlefield. And they will use material that they gather to manipulate the media, to push their own view, to distort the views of their opponents. They're very clever at this game. They were a leading power, let's say, in this area during the Cold War, and they're bringing all the skills that they developed during the Cold War to bear now on countries like the UK, essentially driven by the crisis and the war in Ukraine.
We've obviously got two big elections coming up in the UK and also in the US. Do you think that this kind of warfare, if you like, could have an impact on them?
Well, of course it will. I mean, I think we'll see evidence of meddling. And I'm of the view that probably they don't have the capability to, as it were, affect election results. But they certainly have the capability to, well, do much more than annoy us, to complicate things and, as it were, to distort maybe particular debates, particular instances. You just use that example of Jeremy Corbyn producing these documents about, you know, privatization of the national health. And, I mean, I had my emails, I had my ciphered emails hacked back in the first half of 2022 when I was very active with a group on Brexit issues. I was exercising my democratic rights as a citizen to be highly active politically on certain issues. And yet the Russians giving this material to journalists who were in their pocket, you know, then spun it as a conspiracy with me at the center of a conspiracy, trying to, you know, bring down Theresa May's government. So, I mean, that's a very good example of how they can twist material and reinterpret it. I'm fortunately, although, you know, the news of the hack against me was a big, biggish news story at the time, the mainline media in the West didn't really touch the content of the emails because they realized that, well, there was issues of privacy for a start, but on the other hand, there were also the question that it had been through Russian hands, so you couldn't trust that the emails were exactly as they had existed when I wrote them or when I received them.
He strays into some quite interesting territory there, doesn't he? Saying, although this was all that my emails were leaked, that he was involved in, apparently, in some sort of conspiracy to do with Brexit, the press wouldn't publish it because, you know, he was who he is, and they were worried about privacy, that he's obviously got money to sue them, which some people don't have, like we don't have. And so this puts him in this sort of elite club that, well, he gets to know, obviously as an ex-boss of MI6, when there's about to be a story on him, and he can kind of get it shut up. But anyway, the main thing he's talking about there is that, oh, well, the Russians are very good at this, and they are kind of manipulating everything.
Well, interesting. I did read the stuff that was leaked about him, and of course this was after he'd been the head of MI6.
This was only about 18 months ago, yes, it was leaked.
Right. Yeah. So in other words, he's the ex-head of MI6 by this stage.
So the headline in The Guardian was "Hard Brexit Plans by Ex-MI6 Chief Hacked and Leaked by the Russians."
Yeah, well, I mean, there's two aspects to this. One is the ex-head of MI6 was conspiring to try and destroy Theresa May's government and bring in a harder Brexit. That was his view.
No, but he has a right to do that.
He does have the right to view
that. As a citizen, as he said.
But it is interesting, isn't it, when you've got the conspiracy theories on the right about who really manipulates things and what they really want.
But isn't it fascinating that someone who's ex-boss of MI6 can be involved in this campaign for a hard Brexit? And obviously, he's got some incredible contacts and knowledge.
Oh, yes, all right. So
he's a civil servant.
Yes, I know. Well, let's put the Brexit side of it aside, because, I mean, you know, in a sense, that's a red rag to a bull. The point
is... Or, I'm going to say, a rabbit hole for you and I.
Well, indeed. Yeah. And we need some ferrets down these rabbit holes, don't we? The main question of the stuff about the Russian information warfare, I mean, it's just ludicrous. All the Russians were doing and have done is have something like RT, which is a rather boring, you know, in some respects, plodding news channel, which doesn't, in fact, have that, you know, there's no headlines like in The Sun or anything like that, you know, gotcha or Putin's missile or anything like that. And their influence on British public opinion, even when they were allowed to speak, was negligible. Negligible. Most people are absolutely profoundly ignorant of what the Russians think about anything.
Well, I mean, funnily enough, they're not told about it. Put the full version of that up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Is he actually does go into that, and he holds his hands up and he says, well, actually, I don't really think the Russians can make much of a difference.
Well, of course they can't, because in actual fact, the people who are making a difference are the Israelis, who are using US taxpayer money to try and buy politics in Britain. That's what they do. And then on top of that, you've then got the tech giants, the financial services industry, the arms industry, etc. I mean, the Russians are like a prime in the wilderness.
Your MI6 James Bonds of this world, aren't they paid to make sure that the Israelis don't do that?
Well, in theory, that's what they're supposed to do, but in practice, of course, they're all in the same game. So what they're doing, as we said last week, is projection. The main skill that Western intelligence services and military have is psychological warfare operations, or at least that's the way they perceive it.
How about cyber war?
Yes, cyber war as well, all of that, yeah. But at the same time, they're not really very good at the technical parts of cyber war. They're more interested in what you might call the idea of cyber war.
How about actual fighting? How about economic warfare?
Well, their idea of economic warfare was to declare sanctions on Russia and therefore boost the Russian economy and destroy the Western economy, which tends to suggest that either A, they don't know what they're doing, or B, that's not really what they say they're doing, is not what they're really doing.
So they're running out of different types of warfare that they can actually do. What about space warfare?
Well, they've had the idea that the unipolar moment, that they were going to control everything, including that they're very still obsessed with the idea of controlling psychological space. So that they've now set up something called the Global Ukraine History Initiative. I was reading about this yesterday, where they're going to rewrite the history of the Ukraine according to what they think it should have been. Whereas in actual fact, the existing, you know, historians who study the Ukraine are obviously not up to the job. So they've got all these people who know nothing about it, including Yuval Harari, for example, from Israel. And they're going to rewrite the whole history. But they're obsessed with this idea that controlling the mind is controlling the physical space. The Russians do it the other way round. They're fighting a battle, a physical battle, with guns and bombs and bullets, and then there is a psychological aspect to it. The West approach things that we've got psychological warfare and a bit of killing on as well. And they're very good at killing, but not very good at winning. They've not really thought through a lot of the things, which is good, because if they were any good, the world would be in a very much worse place than it is.
Sounds like, you know, you are they painting themselves into a corner? That's what you sound like you're
saying. Well, I mean, I think they are, but of course the danger is...
But these guys have got nukes, Martin.
I know, the danger is, if there was no nukes, this had already been decided on the battlefield. But nukes changes everything. Nobody can afford to stray into that, although we may stray in by accident. This is the problem. Getting rid of all these arms control agreements and treaties means that we used to be able to pretty confidently say they're not going to be using nukes. We can't say that anymore because the West has ripped up all of these treaties, which we did with the evil Soviet Union, but apparently with newly democratic Russia, we can't be bothered carry through on it.
Philippa talked about the Samson auction there. Will the Israelis really go that far? I mean, surely the whole world would turn on them at that point.
Yeah, but I mean, if they did it...
Even the Americans.
Well, I mean, the point is, the Samson option would be, for example, if they were to carry out a nuclear attack on Iraq. Okay? Iran. And of course, what they say, and also, of course, as Martin von Krevelt, who's an Israeli defense intellectual, pointed out years ago, they're actually pointing at Rome.
What about, Beirut or Damascus, if the Lebanese or the Syrians were to invade?
The problem with using nuclear weapons on places too close to you is you get destroyed as well, if you're not directly hit. This is the problem for Israel and Pakistan, India and Pakistan.
Is that why we had Martin van Creveld threatening, I think it was, to bomb London and Berlin?
That's right. That's where the real threat, you know, they're not going to use it on Jordan because then they'd be infected by it. But I mean, what we really ought to have...
Come on, Bond!
What we really ought to have is, the major nuclear powers, the US, the Russians, the Chinese, can have intercontinental ballistic missiles in their territory, which means that they've got a security against being attacked, and nobody else should have any nuclear weapons at all.
Well,
that's the solution.
On the positive side of this, Biden's staff, it's just the sort of stuff we don't hear on the mainstream news at all. Biden staffers have demanded a ceasefire at a historic White House vigil Wednesday night. Every single one of these people is risking their jobs and possibly their careers because they know the stakes of this moment, said one campaigner. Dozens of Biden administration staffers held a vigil outside the White House calling for a lasting ceasefire in Gaza as the Palestinian territory's healthcare system collapsed and the US armed Israeli military bombed the entirety of the besieged strip. The staffers donned masks and sunglasses to conceal their identities, likely out of fear of retaliation from an administration that's been accused of cracking down on dissent. This is the Jake Sullivans and the like, against President Joe Biden's support for Israel's assault on Gaza. Josh Paul, a former late State Department official who resigned in October over the administration's weapons transfers to Israel, also took part in the demo and delivered remarks on behalf of the staffers. Would be nice to be able to listen to those. I'm not sure if we can. It'd be fascinating to hear it, wouldn't it? This is good to see, isn't it, Martin? There's something like this going on outside the White House.
It is, and I think Biden is getting worried because his re-election chances are looking slimmer and slimmer, and if he loses the youth vote, which the Democrats very much depend on, then he's going to be in trouble.
He's not running, is he, again? I mean, he's never going to get anywhere.
Well, maybe he will die before we get there. Either accidentally or otherwise. Look, and somebody else will...
He's the perfect candidate. He'll say anything or nothing.
Well, no, the point is...
He's apparently on amphetamines the whole time. Well, Did you know that?
I mean, I don't know what he's on.
On Tucker Carlson's show, saying, yeah, well, everybody's saying he cannot get through the day without speed.
Well, that was true of John F. Kennedy and Hitler, so there you go. The point about Biden is he is the establishment's candidate to keep Bernie Sanders out in the first place. That's why he's there. That's the only reason why he's there. And the problem is if the Democratic Party is obviously no better than the Republican Party in many respects, but the alternative is equally unpleasant. Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who people might have looked to as somebody that would you know, cut through all of this, he is absolutely 100% behind what's going on in Gaza. Biden is now wobbling because, you know, he's got to, you know, he basically got to think about his own political future. But in the long run, there may be a big explosion as the youth of the United States rebel against exactly what, you know, this has been the kind of crystallizing issue here. And it'll be interesting to see how this plays out.
It will. On the other side of the table is a certain Vladimir Putin who's been having one of his marathon press conferences yesterday. He will take questions from all sorts of... he had this little chit-chat with an AI... simulation of himself, didn't he?
I don't know. Did
yeah, he did. Yeah, and the simulated version of Putin said, "Do you have any body doubles?" Which I thought was rather a good joke. But anyway, they do things differently at the White House. You know, the John Kirby and the rest of them. But anyway, this I thought was quite extraordinary, and redacted with Clayton Morris covered it.
President Putin giving a multi-hour press conference. Imagine President Biden doing an over 3-hour press conference where he took questions from you just wouldn't believe the amount of questions this guy just took. He took questions from all over the Russian Federation, from random individuals at universities, from reporters about the war, about de-dollarization.
He took a question, shockingly, from the New York Times, which my jaw about hit the floor because we're told that they only answer questions to friendly media and no opposition media. So what is the New York Times doing there being invited? She actually said, "Thank you so much for having me." And he said, "It never was me, actually, that didn't want you here. I'm always willing to answer democratic questions."
Where am I?
That happened.
What?
Yeah.
So kind of crazy. I mean, talking about de-dollarization and the amount of dollars they're now using for transactions has plummeted. It used to be at 87% for using U.S. dollars to settle transactions. And he said it's the West's fault. Literally under sanctions, we now are down to about 20% using the dollar. This is the decline of the U.S. dollar. Also talking about how they will absolutely move for demilitarization of Ukraine. That country will be demilitarized, in his words. And he called Ukrainians a bunch of freeloaders right now, that they're literally importing everything they're using. Their manufacturing has been totally destroyed. Everything that's coming in is being basically given to them for free by NATO and the United States and the West, and it's all being shipped in there with no capacity for repayment.
Yeah, so Martin, he's a bit of a pro, isn't he, Putin? He seems to be, unless he's being filtered by the Western media, he's doing very well. Of course, this is the sort of thing. The elections are coming up in Russia, aren't they? Is it next year sometime? And this is the sort of thing which will it's pretty soon. This is the sort of thing which will endear him to the population. I don't imagine any of the other candidates are going to get such an opportunity to have a whole day press conference asking questions from all over the Russian Federation and from foreign correspondents from foreign newspapers.
Well, his political position is relatively unassailable. He's more popular than his party, United Russia. But he's also, quite clearly in a different league from the political leadership in the West. And that includes people like Keir Starmer, who are supposedly relatively intellectually capable compared to, you know, your Liz Trusses and so forth.
Well, do you want to describe the difference between the two systems? Because we've discussed this before off the back of a brilliant interview with Michael Hudson about these two different economic systems. You've got this kind of mixed economy version of capitalism that Russia has now taken up after the fall of the Soviet Union under the guidance of Putin. And we've now got this kind of gangster capitalism, personified, I suppose, by the recent Milei, the guy in Argentina, who is now saying, "Well, I think we might just get rid of our bank and just go over to using dollars." So the idea that you've just got one kind of financial empire, which is slowly taking over the whole of the West.
Well, on the economic front, I think what's happened is that both the Russians and the Chinese have learned through experience what does and doesn't work. The Chinese have learned that having a complete top-down command economy isn't functional, but they certainly haven't gone in for all the complete, you know, they've kept substantial sections of their economy under political direction. They've not allowed, there is a sort of billionaire class in China, but they're not given political power. They're allowed to make money, but they're not allowed to make decisions about the direction of travel.
This is like the oligarchs, isn't it?
Yeah. So there's a tension in the oligarchs.
They were told very clearly in the 2000s, you put your hands anywhere near the Kremlin, they're going to get chopped off.
Yeah, well, I mean, what you've got in Russia now is it's now a market economy, but which it wasn't before. As a result of the shock reforms and all the rest of it, but they've lots of stuff was renationalised. For example, the oil industry and the gas industry, they're not going to allow that to fall into foreign hands. You know, they're not going to take a sort of laissez-faire attitude to that, because they know that's the end. You know, that's putting foreign hands around the throat of the country. So Khodorkovsky, who was eventually sent to prison and then went into exile, and is one of Putin's outspoken opponents. He was basically about to hand over the oil and gas industry in Siberia to Israeli and Western interests. And that was the point at which the Siloviki, as they called them, the security structure, which was what was left of the Soviet nomenklatura, decided we can't have this. We've got to regain control.
Also, they'd learnt a lot through watching Yeltsin and the way he was being.
Well, that's right. They'd been there, done it, and got the T-shirt and realised that this isn't going to work. It's not like, when I first went to Russia in the 1990s and talked to people, they thought Yeltsin was wonderful, and they said, we just want to be like you, can't we have Margaret Thatcher over here? And I was felt like saying to them, well, you'll get it, but you won't like it. And that's exactly what happened. They got it, and they really didn't like it. And they're not going back there. So the right wing of the Tory party here thinking that anybody in Russia thinks that they need to do more privatisation. Privatisation is dead as an ideology. It carries on because it's a practice. But in terms of whether it's any good or not, the jury's in. It's rubbish, and everybody knows it is.
Yeah, well, they certainly do, as these various privatised industries start falling to bits, or else just being shut down and these jobs moved abroad. So Putin says, we were talking just now about New York Times quizzing him, nothing like Gaza is happening in Ukraine. The Russian president, Vladimir Putin, has called the military offensive in Gaza catastrophic as he faced Western journalists at a major press conference for the first time since Moscow's war in Ukraine began. So that's about 18 months ago. He said that what was happening in the enclave was a tragedy, adding that nothing like this is happening in Ukraine. Look at the catastrophic situation in Gaza and the special operations war in Ukraine and feel the difference, Mr. Putin said on Thursday at his end-of-year news conference. He answered questions from local and international journalists, including from Western media. He's heavily limited his interaction with the foreign media since the fighting began almost 22 months ago. Well, he's done that because you get hardly any translated things of the Russian leader's speeches. Come on, Moscow. You know, we need to have translated into English, not just we Brits or we Yanks, but the whole world speaks English, almost. So get them translated. I hope you're listening. Putin was greeted with applause as he arrived at the venue in central Moscow, where ordinary citizens also got the chance to phone in their questions to the president. Commenting on Israel's military offensive in Gaza, he insisted on the need to protect civilians, provide massive humanitarian support in the besieged territory. So why isn't he doing that, Martin? Why is Russia not providing humanitarian support? Why is it not making sure that aid is getting into there? I mean, don't tell me Russia is not able to do that. It's one of the most powerful military forces on earth.
Well, one of the things is that they're positioning themselves to be mediators in any peace negotiations, which means that they pride themselves on speaking to both sides. So Israel Haniyeh, the head of Hamas, went to Moscow to talk to him, and at the same time he picks up the phone. You know, Bibi Netanyahu will pick up the phone when Putin phones him, and that's always been Putin's style. Yeah, he talks to everybody.
He prays.
And therefore, he's got to be quite careful about how far he's going to go in what he says, because he wants to keep the Israelis on side, because he wants to negotiate.
Just a minute, it's just hot air, isn't it, saying that that there must be humanitarian aid? He's not doing anything.
Well, if you want, yeah, but you've got. We just discussed.
The Jordanians have actually flown in some aid there.
Yeah, but
not the Russians.
If it comes to a shooting match between the Russian Navy and the NATO Navy, including the British Navy, off the coast of Gaza, that could escalate to nuclear war just like that. So you've got to take this into account, Tony. The Russians and the Chinese are very well aware that they're dealing with psychopathic people who've got nuclear weapons. And therefore, they speak very carefully when they're dealing. Look at Lavrov, how carefully he speaks. Every word is carefully measured, and you've got to read between the lines. This is exactly what's lost on blowhards. But although like, it's, you know, like Liz Truss, for example, who just blurts out whatever's in her mind.
Or David Lammy, maybe.
Nothing in there.
He praised Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan for his leading role in the Gaza efforts, saying he's doing everything to change it for the better and create conditions for long-term peace. Well, this, I mean, it's a big swing state, Turkey, isn't it?
Yeah.
And they've been absolutely condemned the Israelis. They're saying Israel's a terrorist state, that sort of thing. But again, doing nothing. And in fact, maybe the Turks are eyeing that territory, thinking we want it back after the Ottoman Empire.
Well, they could cut off the oil supply to Israel, but if they did that, the Americans would then destabilise the Turkish lira and make another attempt to overthrow the government, as they did when they had the military coup against
Erdogan. Yeah, but would they be successful a second time?
Well, I'm just saying, the point is, if you've got that gun pointed at your head, you've got to be quite careful what you do and don't do. It's all very well saying you should do this and you should do that.
I mean, is it fair to say it's a swing state? Maybe.
Yes,
Turkey,
of course it is. It's a key state.
Maybe Turkey is actually aligning itself with Russia now, and there's no real hope of them ever going back to being friends with the Americans, even though the Americans have got, for example, nuclear weapons based at Incirlik Air Base in Turkey.
Well, what's happening is everybody's assessing where they stand in this great.
They get quite a lot of demos there, don't they?
They do. They do. The whole world is being forced to take sides around what's happening, and it's not just about Gaza. It's about what's been going on in the Ukraine. It's what's happened in Nagorno-Karabakh, for example. It's the conflict in West Africa. It's the BRICS countries. It's the election in Argentina. Everything is interacting with everything else, and it's all very well saying to people. I mean, you can't second guess. People are in the position that somebody like Putin is in. He's got to be very careful what he says, and he's got to keep a lot of what he's really thinking to himself, because you can't just tell everybody what's going on.
Would recognise you cannot push the Turks around, and he would maybe be warning against the coup attempt, saying, "Look, when this backfires, you're going to." You know, be sorry, because that will mean that the Turks are much more aligned to the Russians than they will be to us. So, I mean, you know, the Turkey it seems to me is a genuinely independent state that's deciding which way it wants to go on its own. But there's not many left like that.
No, well, that's because of the geography and the size of the army and things like that. I mean, you know, they're going to have.
In Europe, it's the politics, isn't it? I mean, it's also that everyone is aligned with the Americans through the EU.
Well, yeah, and through NATO.
Except Viktor Orban, by the way. What do you make of this announcement today about his vetoing the, or trying anyway, or he's actually vetoed the money going from the EU to Ukraine, hasn't he?
He has. And this is the problem, you know, for the managers of the EU and NATO, the problem is that in theory it's a consensus organisation with veto powers for individual countries.
Yeah, it's qualified
in practice, it's run by the Americans with the British as junior officers, and everybody else has to do as they're told.
This is a big thing that very few people talk about in the EU. They're trying to get rid of this veto power and turn over to, on various different topics, turn over to qualified majority voting. So what do you make of Orban? I mean,
Orban is a cultural conservative in Hungarian terms. He doesn't like gays and all the rest of it. But in terms of international policy, small countries like Hungary, and they're smaller and much less important than Turkey. They try to leverage their situation by, you know, swinging this way and that in order to extract concessions from whoever. I mean, they're still receiving gas from Russia, I understand. And, that's in their interest, you know. That means that they're not having the same crisis that other places are having because they're getting Russian gas. They want to carry on doing that. At the same time, they want EU subsidy for what they do. And of course, there's a quite clear interest in Hungary is not one of the Ukrainians in the EU. They are net beneficiaries from the EU budget. Once the Ukrainians come in, all the money that's being given to Hungary is going to Ukraine.
Look, the choo-choo train has started chugging. Ukraine is going to join the EU. These talks have now begun. It might be a while.
There's still a veto.
It might be a while, and of course, yeah, but we've had vetoes before, haven't we?
Yeah.
About joining NATO, about joining the EU, and this sort of thing. What happens is, slowly but surely, deals are done, and people like Orban are brought round.
No, Orban won't be brought round, and there's huge opposition. If you saw what's happening on the Polish border, the Polish truckers and farmers have been blockading the border to stop Ukrainian truckers and farmers sending food and other such stuff into Poland. And that's because it's going to put them out of work if they're allowed to do that. So the and the Polish government, the new Polish centrist government, I won't call it left wing, who wants to say who want to fight the Russians to keep the Americans happy. The problem is that that's going to put everybody in Poland out of work. Now that's why EU Ukraine isn't joining the EU anytime soon.
What about Venezuela and Guyana? There's another bit of a dispute kicking off there, isn't there? Actually, no. It looks like as of yesterday, that may not be. It may be calming down a little bit, but it's all over an oil-rich region which was recently discovered, which is a disputed area between Guyana and Venezuela.
Yeah, well, the dispute goes back to the 19th century when the British. Us, we gave that it was because that part, that area was traditionally part of Venezuela or part of the Spanish Empire. Eh? But the British insisted that they should have it. And at the time, there's only a few thousand people living there. And the British got their decision the way they wanted it with American help, I believe. And it was handed over to British Guyana, which then became independent to become Guyana as it is today.
So the Venezuelans wanted to pinch it, did they?
Well, the Venezuelans say it always belonged to us. They've always resisted the idea that it was part of Guyana. Now, this is a fairly obscure dispute. Most people haven't heard of it until it's just blown up. But I think what has been agreed is that there's going to be no military solution to it. So the Venezuelans aren't saying they're going to invade or anything. They're just saying because it is a substantial issue. Because if there is oil reserves there, leaving Monbiot's desire that we're not going to exploit any of these aside, if there's going to be any oil there, then but they're both relatively poor countries. It's in, they want their cut of what's going to be made from that oil. That's what this is about. I mean, you've got a lot of poor people in Venezuela and in Guyana, and but the Guyanese government at the moment is aligned with the West. Previously, the Guyanese government has been part of the sort of left wing. They're the only English speaking country in Latin America, but they've had left wing governments. Walter Rodney came from Guyana, who was assassinated by the CIA, and so on. So, I mean, all of these disputes are there. This is just another dispute that's out there. The Kurds aren't very happy with the centralized Turkish state. We could circle it back round to that. These issues are all over the place, not just in Israel-Palestine.
I wanted to go on to talk about the Gaza business again. Or to get back to that, because I think we need to address a really biggie, which is we're off air for the next, 3 weeks. We're having a nice Christmas break. And by the way, thank you very much to Patrizia Opulenza for a little parcel that arrived early this week. We'll be dishing that out to our various staff members, Martin, Dave and I. But the big question over the line, which I will certainly be looking at and wondering about over the next few weeks, is... The Israelis must be thinking about some kind of a false flag attack, Martin, because this is all, at the moment, this is just looking really bad for them. The whole world is starting to turn against Israel. The only option really left to Netanyahu is to take some sort of weapons of mass destruction, something similar. He's not short of nukes or chemical weapons and that sort of thing. It's very likely that he's got access to these things. And he could just lob it around somewhere and just say, oh, well, this is Iran. Or he could even say, oh, it's China. One thing you can be sure is whatever comes out of his mouth will be the opposite of the truth. But what do you make of this over the next few weeks?
Well, let's just take...
And it may be longer, but it may not happen, but it's certainly a possibility, isn't it?
Well, we've already had a false flag, which was October the 7th. It was a let it happen on purpose false flag. And we haven't mentioned this on the show, but we ought to have mentioned it. The stock trades, which took place a few days before, which clearly meant somebody who made those stock trades had foreknowledge of the attack, just like on 9/11.
Maybe Hamas.
Yeah, well, that's what the suggestion has been this time. And, of course, when they did the investigation into the stock trades for 9/11, they found that it did link back to Buzzy Krongard, who is ex-deputy director of the CIA. But then it couldn't possibly have been a terrorist link thing because he wasn't from Al-Qaeda. You see how the logic works? Now, I think the intelligence services of the world, including, say, the MIT in Turkey and the FSB in Russia, will have worked out what's happened on October the 7th. It was a deliberately allowed... Hamas had their own agenda. They expected to get through the fence, capture some prisoners and get back, and it would be a quick in, quick out, and then there would be a standoff. When they got there, there was only one battalion there, and there used to be three. They got through the fences without anybody being stopped at all. Then, when they captured prisoners, the Israelis killed those prisoners to up the death toll... all of this makes it look more and more false flaggy. And I think that the liberal Zionists are beginning to think they've been sold a pup here by Netanyahu. You were talking earlier about the relatives of the hostages. It's becoming blindingly clear to them that the government does not care about those hostages. They really don't. And you saw what Jonathan Pollard, the ex-spy, was saying. We had him on the other week. We had a clip from him. He says that the families of the hostages should just shut up because we've got our chance now to finish the Palestinians off for good. And they're not even finessing that. They come out straight out and say it. And I think this is the problem for people like Keir Starmer is going to find it very difficult to hold this line. He's already nailed his colours to the mast, but as this goes, we're going into the new year, towards an election year, he is going to have to either climb down or stick to his guns, in which case he is going to be ripped to pieces because the rest of world public opinion is going to be solidly against him.
Yeah, I mean, you're right to bring this up, Martin. Of course you are. The new paper last week by Robert Jackson Jr., a former commissioner of America's Securities and Exchange Commission, and Joshua Mills of Columbia University suggests that there was an enormous amount of short sales, bets that a security price will fall, of an exchange-traded fund, ETF, listed on the New York Stock Exchange under the ticker ETS, which tracks an index of Israeli shares. In September, an average of 1,581 shares a day of EIS were sold short, representing 17% of the daily total trading volume. On October the 2nd, 5 days before the attack, a whopping 227,000 shares were shorted, representing 99% of the total volume. Rather than reflecting a souring of market sentiment, the increase in activity seems to have come from just two trades. I mean, this is fascinating, isn't it? Who made these trades? These people should be handcuffed. Why, obviously. How did you know? What were you up to?
Well, if it was Hamas, that would be understandable. But if Hamas is trying to carry out a secret operation, they wouldn't carry out trades like that because that would flag it up. So it's somebody else, isn't it? Somebody in the Israeli Defence Forces, I dare say.
And it is quite interesting, since they have published the evidence that the silly old Guardian says Israel investigates claims investors made millions. No, they did make millions. And by the way, you don't need to say claims, the word claims. It's not, you don't have to be afraid of these people. Come on, Guardian. If you're going to guard the truth, maybe you're guarding something else. So, I'll put a link up to that on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. But I'm going to drag you back, Martin, to this idea of the false flag. It's possible that we'll see something. You know, this is the way things work. You switch on the TV in the morning, or maybe halfway through the day, something happens and you think, good God. All I'd say, if anything like that does happen, folks, please do hit record on your televisions and make sure you record everything that you hear and see on radio and television, because quite often there's stuff that comes out that then gets deleted. As another story this week, it's saying that the Israeli Defence Forces went round deleting border videos of the 7th of October. I don't know about the veracity of those claims, but I'll put a link up to the story anyway on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. And it could be a bit like the 7/7 attacks here in London, or 9/11 attacks, where suddenly the CCTV wasn't working. Actually, what happened at 7/7 is someone had come round and collected it, and it was never seen again.
Well, that's right, because probably what it shows is that Hamas got through the fence without any opposition whatsoever, because they were allowed through. Now, in other words, the people running the Israeli state are traitors to their own state. And that, of course, could lead to civil war.
So not like ours, of course.
Well, no, the point is that it's all the same stuff. But, of course, they're all linked as well. On 7/7, of course, Netanyahu was in London and didn't go to a meeting at Liverpool Street because the Israeli embassy gave him a warning.
You're painting this picture of a sort of little clique running Britain, America and Israel.
Well, listen, at the top level, There are a few people who are the senior gangsters.
And maybe even a religious,
you know, the capos.
A religious cult. This is the best way to keep people's mouths shut. You have a cult. So that's effectively, you know, people are going to keep their mouths shut because they have, like in the mafia, they've agreed that if you don't keep your mouth shut, that you can come and bump them off. Now, this is the sort of thing that concerns me, that these sort of cults are not really being investigated properly. But anyway, look, just to get back to this false flag thing, what do you make of the sorts of things that we might see if something does pop up on our television?
Well, you mentioned this earlier, Tony. Apparently, three Hamas operatives have been arrested in Germany and in the Netherlands on their way to attack Jewish targets in Germany and the Netherlands. I don't believe that, Tony. I just don't believe it.
Four Hamas members have been arrested for planning attacks on Jewish institutions in Europe, according to German prosecutors. Three of them were detained in Berlin and another in the Netherlands. That's the very latest on this. And Dominic Kane, our correspondent in Berlin, who has more on that developing situation. What more are we hearing about this, Dominic?
We're hearing more information specifically about the individuals you were mentioning there who've been arrested and their provenance. So we know, if you'll allow me to read quickly from a press release from the federal authorities here, they are described as being Lebanese-born Abdelhamid Al-A. In German law, we're not allowed to reveal the surnames of suspects when they're arrested. That's why it's like that. Mohammed B, Nazi R, who were all arrested in Germany, and a further person, Ibrahim El A, who was arrested in the Netherlands. Now, they are all accused of being members of Hamas. Remember, in this country, Hamas is officially, according to German law, a terrorist organization. The essence of the allegation against them is that starting in the spring of this year at the latest, one of the individuals concerned, Abdelhamid Al-A, was involved in locating an underground weapons depot in Europe on behalf of Hamas, says the allegation from the authorities, and that he took his instructions from leading Hamas cadres in Lebanon, it says here. The suggestion is that the weapons were going to be taken to Berlin and kept ready for possible attacks on Jewish institutions, it says here, in Europe. Now, the interesting thing here is an European arrest warrant has been issued by the authorities here for the person in the Netherlands, the suggestion being that that person would be extradited here. Certainly those who are physically in custody right now, well, they will be brought before a judge tomorrow morning, where we will obviously hear more details, officially that is, about what is alleged against them.
And of course, Dominic, the situation has also developed in Denmark, with arrests there also pertaining to the war on Gaza.
That's right. And this is where it becomes slightly more intricate, because this morning the Danish authorities said that they had apprehended three people who they said were being arrested in connection with allegations of terrorism, their words. And the news conferences were given by relevant ministers talking about the situation. Now, subsequent to that, the spokesperson for the office of the Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, has said that seven people were arrested by Danish authorities. Now, what is not clear is whether that is seven people physically in Denmark, or whether what this is taking place is an operation across several European countries coordinated such that seven people were arrested. That is not clear, and as yet no specific agency has been able to provide us any more clarification about the sorts of offences that are alleged to have taken place. But clearly, Sahel, this is a developing situation.
Dominic Kane there for us in Berlin. Thank you.
So I think that was from Sky, that report, Martin. But a former British counter-terror chief has said there are grave concerns for UK security after the arrests of four suspects in Europe who were allegedly part of a Hamas terrorism plot. Denmark has stepped up its terror inquiry on Friday, holding two people in custody while four others were being targeted by investigations after claims that European countries had thwarted a suspected Hamas plot. Dutch police also arrested a suspect, while several alleged Hamas members have been detained in Germany. Chris Phillips, former head of UK's National Counter-Terrorism Security Office, told The Eye that the events in Europe would raise grave concerns in the UK. Whilst there might be some in the UK with links to Hamas who will have been deterred from acting after seeing the arrests across Europe, there will be some who will accelerate their plans if they think there is an increased chance of their plan being blown now, Mr. Phillips said. So I suppose these are the kind of natural consequences of a security state in Britain and of course in Germany and Denmark too, which has been supporting the Israeli war crimes. So they can almost, they expect some sort of a backlash. Although, of course, the Palestinian marches have been peaceful marches. Very few even arrested for things like hate crimes and that sort of thing. It's almost by going along with the Israelis, we've created this little terrorism nightmare for ourselves.
Well, I think I don't necessarily think that's the case. I don't necessarily believe these people are Hamas. They say they are. What does Hamas say? It doesn't make any sense for them to do something like that. That's not the strategy they've been pursuing, is it? So in other words, it looks like they're being set up here in one way or another. An interesting parallel to this is in Argentina, back in the day, there was an attack on a Jewish community centre, which was blamed on Hamas, and it became a big cause célèbre in Argentina, because it looked pretty much as if ultimately that was Mossad that had bombed the community centre, the Israeli community centre, and claiming to be Hamas. Mm. Don't forget, Hamas itself was set up by the Israelis. Just think about how the British Army ran the IRA's nutting squad via steak knife.
There's two things to say here. One is we've got a general election next year. We know that in the 2017 general election there were a whole load of these, I would consider false flag attacks.
Yeah.
All of those cases, it was the Manchester Arena bombing, the Westminster Bridge bombing and the London Bridge bombing, the ringleaders had been reported to the MI5 anti-terror hotline. And yet all those were allowed by MI5 to go ahead. So one does wonder what the purpose of MI5 is. Maybe they are actually organising these terrorist attacks. But, of course, they have a political agenda. In 2017, it was to destabilise Jeremy Corbyn and to brand him as a terrorist.
Yes, and in this particular case, what it is an attempt by the pro-Israeli faction within the Western deep state, and they're pretty strong in Germany, yeah? The BND have been involved in all sorts of skullduggeries around Navalny, for example, like, you know, the false, supposedly poisoned underpants and all the rest of it. You can't take anything these people say with as gospel at all. And it's very handy for the Israelis at this point, when they're under huge pressure about what they're doing, is if Hamas terrorists happen to just pop up and get arrested on their way to kill innocent Jews in Germany, and it's... You know,
we've also got the festive
season. It may well
season.
Turn out that there's nothing got, in this at all, or the whole plot has been orchestrated by the intelligence service.
I mean, I'm just looking back at things like the 7/7 attacks and the 2017 terror attacks, thinking, maybe the same sort of thing will happen again. During the festive season, we might see something which is designed to really destroy your Christmas by having some sort of hideous act take place. It could even be the Israelis behind it, because they were certainly
involved. That's
right,
and of course what they'll do is they say it's Hamas did this. Now, I think the way...
We just look for a minute at the 7/7, because we know... No, don't we? Netanyahu was over here in Britain at the time of the 7/7 attacks, wasn't he?
He was, and he didn't go to his meeting at Liverpool Street that day, because when the Times of Israel phoned the embassy to say, is Bibi all right? They said, yes, he's fine. We had a warning about the attack. Now, if I was head of the Metropolitan Police, I'd say that's pretty clear evidence of foreknowledge and therefore possibly complicity, or even the fact that they're behind it. Now, these facts are actually established. There's no dispute about them. And the film we made with the BBC, they ran that
allegation. The conspiracy
past,
files.
Yeah, they ran that allegation past the Israeli embassy, and they said, "Oh yes, but we had a warning, but we can't tell you anything about it."
Ours, I'm afraid. Well, yes, it was Dan Shaham at the Israeli embassy, the spokesperson there, that spoke to journalists that morning and told them, "Yes, we had a warning," and then Scotland Yard then denied, didn't they, that they'd had a warning? This is the sort of thing we could potentially expect, whether it's in the run-up to election or over the festive period. So let's hope to God that doesn't happen. If it does, as I say, hit play and record. A better film than the one we're talking about, which we featured in by the BBC, was called Ludicrous Diversion, and it kind of crosses over in that film in looking at inquiries generally. And so we haven't really much talked about the COVID inquiry, but let's have a look at that in the light of the failure to have a public inquiry into the 7/7 attacks, and also the COVID inquiry too.
If you have examined any of the information released about the attacks of the 7th of July, or if you get your news from a reputable source, i.e. one outside of the mainstream media, then you probably are one of those advocating an inquiry into the London bombings. We suggest you stop wasting your time. Why? Because full public inquiries are not full, and they're not public. These terms are used simply to delude us into thinking that the process of an inquiry is intended to uncover the truth about something. This is simply not the case. Let's recall the last major public inquiry held in the UK. The Hutton Inquiry, set up to investigate the apparent suicide of Dr. David Kelly, with a side mandate of examining whether the government manipulated intelligence to facilitate the invasion of Iraq. Given that Hutton was appointed by Lord Faulkner, the very man who continues to declare that the Iraq invasion was somehow legal, it is unsurprising that Hutton absolved Blair and his government of blame. The inquiry refuted allegations that the government had lied about information on Iraq's non-existent weapons of mass destruction, something that any rational person doing an hour of research can see clearly that they did. And more incredulously, Hutton ruled that Dr. David Kelly committed suicide, despite all the physical and medical evidence that clearly points to him having been murdered. But it gets worse. As if public inquiries were already not pointless enough, a recent piece of legislation now guarantees that they will never be anything other than a charade. On June the 7th, 2005, exactly 1 month before the London bombings, the Inquiries Act became law. Under this new act, any inquiry will be controlled by the relevant government minister who is empowered to block public scrutiny of state actions. This inexplicable change to the way inquiries are run was openly criticised by the Law Society of England and Amnesty International, who stated that the new act means that any inquiry will be controlled by the executive. Obviously the one thing you don't want from a supposedly unbiased investigation. The Canadian judge Peter Corey stated, "It seems to me that the proposed new act would make a meaningful inquiry impossible. The commissions would be working in an impossible situation. The minister, the actions of whose ministry was to be reviewed by the public inquiry, would have the authority to thwart the efforts of the inquiry at every step. It really creates an intolerable Alice in Wonderland situation." While the chairman of the US Joint Committee on Human Rights, Congressman Chris Smith, declared that the bill pending before the British Parliament should be named the Public Inquiries Cover-Up Bill. So if this new act makes inquiries so pointless and so easy to control, the question is why Blair, Clark and the rest of them have seemingly done their best to prevent one happening. We suggest that there will be an inquiry. It will be obstructed from the beginning, and it will be controlled by the very people it should be investigating. Be assured it will not be anything approaching a proper investigation. At no point will the inquiry even consider the possibility that the four men labelled as suicide bombers could possibly be innocent, or question the lack of evidence against them. It will pass on verbatim the same meaningless, unverifiable assertions made by the police and by the media's anonymous security sources. But it will avoid completely the major contradictions and problems in the official story. They hope at the end of it, the public will be satisfied. And the public probably will be.
So that's from 2005 itself. It was brought out about 6 months or 8 months after the 7/7 London bombings. Documentary is called A Ludicrous Diversion, referring to Tony Blair's statement that having a public inquiry would be a ludicrous diversion from getting to the truth. Well, this has a fundamental effect on the country, Martin, doesn't it? It's really the politicians taking over the role of the judiciary. So what they're saying is they're no longer we're going to have an independent judiciary. In fact, Lady Justice Hallett, who chaired the 7/7 inquests, is also the one who is chairing the COVID inquiry. So the idea of has caught on around the world. For example, with the New Zealand attack, the New Zealand judiciary have had inquests into the deaths of 50 or so Muslims in the Christchurch mosque, the same as the 2005 bombings inquiry when that eventually took place. This was inquests, which were inquests into the individual deaths. This is completely inappropriate. Even if it was, it's got to be a public inquiry. That's how you deal with multiple deaths, not an inquest. That's into a single death. So anyway, what do you make of the this change away from having proper inquiries? Because it's affected, I mean, it seems to me it's affected massively the rule of law.
Well, the rule of law has never been necessarily a thing, Tony. I mean, there've always been manipulations. The Widgery inquiry into what happened in Bloody Sunday. That was when inquiries were supposedly independent of the state. The judiciary just basically did what the state wanted without being told. They've now got the situation where inquiries are, as you say, because of the Inquiries Act, under the control of the executive. This is exactly why the Papfenucan Centre in Northern Ireland have always been opposed to British inquiries into collusion between the security forces and the paramilitaries.
And because they
want an international inquiry, not a British inquiry, based on a different kind of basis. Peter Crawley was one of those calling for it.
Because of the way the 7-7 inquests were run, there was no proper real look at, for example, the bus bomb. I think it was called The Fourth Bomb, a book by Daniel Obuchicki, who says he was on the bus. Well, I mean, the only real inquiry is going on here is by people like the producers of the documentary you just heard, Ludicrous Diversion. That's a really good inquiry. And so it seems as if the press is the only thing left that will do this. So let's have a listen now to Daniel Obuchicki, right the way back, I think it was 2002, he did something called the Peter Power. No, obviously it wouldn't have been 2002. Maybe, was it 5 years after? So 2010, something called the Peter Power Terror Drill Inquest, which I heard about, and I hopped in the car, or maybe I got on the train, went to London and did a recording of it, which had disappeared with my public inquiry channel, but it's back now. This is the guy that says he was on the bus, Daniel Obuchicki, speaking at that Peter Power Terror Drill Inquest, a fascinating bit of information which never ever made it into the silly old inquest run by the same lady that's running this COVID inquiry now.
No one fitting the description of that guy, I think his name's Hasib Hussein, he's some big hefty guy with a big massive rucksack. Now, I was standing there, people were brushing past me. I never saw no big hench guy with a rucksack go past me. That's it. Now, people might like to speculate that he was already on board the bus from a previous bus stop. I mean, that's something which someone has tried to suggest. I actually saw an individual with a grey, light grey top and a dark grey two-tone rucksack, brown hair, who was sitting upstairs. He had a rucksack. Then he came downstairs. I'm standing downstairs. I'm saying, why is the guy sitting upstairs, then sitting downstairs? To me, I came to the conclusion that he must have been the bomber. He must have planted something upstairs, then sat downstairs. And obviously he got off in the minute before the bomb went off, when the bus driver opened the doors for no apparent reason when there was no bus stop.
Well, he sounds like an interesting chap, so I don't know if you can you just give us as full a description as you can of what he was doing?
He was a European male in his mid-20s, brown, mousy hair. I remember his showerproof top. It was light grey, and the two-tone rucksack. And that's all I really remember of him. He did look at me hesitantly a couple of times, and I looked back at him. I thought he was just another lost kind of person. I thought that's what the reason he was looking at me. And he got off. He was actually the very last person to get off that bus before the driver shut the door, and then the bomb went off 60 seconds or so later.
So that's Daniel Obuchicki, Martin. This is the sort of testimony. This guy would have been on CCTV, but it wasn't even heard in the inquests. And this is the way that these public inquiries operate nowadays.
Well, was there not a public inquiry into the 7-7 bombs?
No, it was they called it an inquest.
So in other words, there
hasn't been an inquiry. Which is actually designed to look into a single death.
Yes. So in other words, the Hallett who's doing the COVID inquiry was doing the inquest. She wasn't doing an inquiry, was she?
There was no inquiry.
So we've got several layers. We've got inquests which aren't adequate. or apart from the coroner's inquest into the killings of Berezovsky and of David, Berezovsky, the coroner decided it probably wasn't suicide. So that one slipped through the net. You've then got inquiries which are fixed, but to varying degrees, either by the judiciary or by the government. And then you've got the truth, which is somewhere else completely different.
Yeah.
So, you know, that doesn't mean that we shouldn't try to get to the truth through legal or journalistic means. Mm. You've got to use whatever's to hand, but it doesn't mean that it's adequate to the task.
To me, it's the journalists are the only people that are going to do this. Nowadays, the deep state makes sure that any kind of officialdom will go nowhere near them. You know, they're making sure that they don't get prosecuted, rather similar way to Netanyahu, the criminal, is making sure he doesn't get prosecuted. Let's have a look, go back to Gaza again now, because this week I spoke to the secretary of Bristol's Palestine Solidarity Campaign, who were down there on Tuesday projecting a Palestinian flag just after dusk onto Bristol's council house to ask Roland Dye, he's the secretary, he's also got, I think, is a PhD in nuclear physics, but to ask him about these accusations of potential neutron bomb use by the Israelis in Gaza, evidenced by this enriched uranium lying around inexplicably across the Gaza Strip.
I've got a PhD in nuclear physics, but I was particularly focusing on medical uses, so avoided weaponry. But I've got a basic understanding, and I was doing a bit of reading just before the interview. So Wikipedia gives quite a succinct summary, of course, that a neutron bomb was a design from, in fact, as far back as the 1950s or 60s. The idea is that it would be a reduced blast at enhanced radiation, which would then be effective at sort of mass armored columns, the so-called Soviet, you know, tank invasions of Western Europe that we were being made to be scared of at the time, and fortifications and bunkers and such like. So it's a relatively small device, but would produce a lot of radiation, which would be lethal to human beings. So the radiation would reach out on a much larger area than the original explosion. It's very complicated. I mean, those soil samples, which were gathered some years ago, are obviously very precious and carry a signature and a witness of what's going on. It's probably hard to actually unravel it all. But on a broader front, Israel makes a fortune from testing novel munitions, and it uses Gaza as a test laboratory. They spend 5% of their GDP on the military, which is actually a bigger proportion than, say, this country or the United States. And they have a multi-billion pound weapons industry. And they're able to sell their weaponry because they're battle-tested.
Can you give us an example of the sort of things that they're testing there?
Well, crowd control, sublethal munitions such as rubber bullets and sponge bullets, skunk water, which is sprayed around liberally in the West Bank when they want to disperse crowds. You've got the whole IT sector, which is, you know, crunching all that data to run the checkpoints and facial recognition. And then you've got the actual lethal weaponry, which is being, well, the surveillance drones over Gaza and microwave beams, whatever it is that they're cooking up, they've got a test laboratory. I remember some years ago, I think it must have been after the 2014 attack, I attended a lecture by a group of medics, and they were showing slides of the injuries which were being seen by the doctors in Gaza, or indeed some of them might have been actually going over and volunteering their services. I mean, these were pretty gruesome, awful imageries, but of course it's what the medics are confronting on a daily basis, and they were pointing out that some of the wounds, people's arms sort of seared off, or the sort of injuries to their skin and such like, were not normal munitions. This wasn't the normal shrapnel from bomb fragments or bullets or whatever. They were talking about tungsten dust, shrapnel made of small cubes of tungsten, which is a much heavier metal, or thing, heat blast weaponry. These were awful wounds, but they're very characteristic. People are probably familiar with the interviews with medics in Gaza at the moment who say they can recognize the wounds from the white phosphorus, which is being sprayed over Gaza, and I saw today in southern Lebanon as well. So these are tiny particles of phosphorus which continue to burn even when they hit the skin, and they will burn down through the tissue and down to the bones. And when exposed to the air, they will reignite and start to burn again, which leave terrible and very hard to treat injuries on the people affected on a mass scale. So it's truly ghastly what's going on in Gaza. It's not a war. It's a genocide and a golden opportunity for Israel to test any new munitions that it might have in the pipeline. So I wouldn't rule anything out, and it just shows the awfulness of the situation going on.
I mean, surely if weapons of mass destruction were being used, it would be news all over the world.
Well, going back to the neutron bombs, these would be relatively small. I mean, I think I was reading something from Chris Busby. These could be as small as a tennis ball or the actual active parts. And we've seen the colossal explosions that are stuff that's being dropped on Gaza, you know, the rockets, the bombs, the artillery shells, being used to just destroy the infrastructure on a mass scale. I mean, it does look like they're trying to make Gaza totally uninhabitable. I mean, even the university, I was told that not only did they shell it or bomb it, but then they put demolition explosives to wreck the building. So this is all part of a scorched earth policy to make Gaza uninhabitable. It is so shocking. It is so shocking. This isn't a war. This is a genocide.
And so what do you think the international community can do? I mean, they've tried several votes now at the United Nations Security Council. Although the General Assembly is behind it, the Americans at the Security Council keep using their veto and the British abstain.
Well, I suppose they get together and they decide who's going to veto it. America decides to do that, and everybody else can just hold their hands up and say it wasn't us. But it is so shocking. I'll say again, we're witnessing a genocide, a slaughter, a terrible havoc being wreaked on largely innocent people, good people, and anybody who's had contact with Palestinians is so good-hearted. Remembering my visits to the West Bank. And it breaks our heart, and that's why people are so upset. That's why the demonstrations have been so big everywhere around the country, including here in Bristol.
So are you saying that the Israelis don't have a right to self-defence?
Well, according to international law, it isn't self-defence because they are the occupying power. So I'm very glad to be able to clear that conundrum up, because that's so widely bandied around in the media, and it's obviously there to be deliberately misleading.
So that's Roland Dye there, Secretary of Bristol's Palestine Solidarity Campaign. The key point he's making there is that actually they have a track record. It's almost like Gaza is Israel's Salisbury Plain. They try everything out there.
Well, that's true, and obviously we've been talking about this a lot tonight, but before I go on, can I remind people that there is a demonstration tomorrow in Bristol, assembling at midday on Castle Park to march to College Green. And obviously the Christmas period is going to be a period of abeyance for these protests, but the last one in Bristol for this year will be tomorrow. And I think with everything that's happening, and also the fact that we've had these Security Council votes and so on, we are making a difference by turning up. So I would advise, encourage anybody.
How are you making
because
a difference?
Because we're putting pressure, all the countries on the Security Council, apart from Britain and the US, were in favour of an immediate ceasefire. That includes our immediate neighbours, like France and Ireland and Spain. And, of course, Guterres is from Portugal. Yeah? So we're talking about Western Europe are already on board.
So
why isn't the Keir Starmer?
Israel, Britain and the US are being isolated, do you think?
Well, that's right. And by protesting inside Britain, we're isolating them further. Yeah? We're turning up the pressure on our own leaders because they are being, you know, the public opinion in this country is clear. They want an immediate ceasefire.
I mean,
as
he's
does
also
everybody
saying,
else.
Roland is also saying there that it is quite feasible that these nuclear weapons may have been tested there, these small nukes, that the actual conventional bombs give much greater blast, or that could be, you know, a cover for a smaller bomb going off, a nuclear neutron bomb.
Yeah, well,
there has to be some explanation for this enriched uranium lying around in Gaza.
Yes, and if Chris Busby has said that he's convinced that they have been using neutron weapons, and of course that then crosses a nuclear threshold, if you like. But in terms of destruction, it's probably not as destructive as some of the bunker busting bombs and so on.
Yeah, what they do destroy is human genetic material.
Yes, that's right. So in other words, it's to do with destroying the genetic future of the Palestinian population. That is as wicked as it gets, really, if you think about it. And the world is now waking up to all of this. And, of course, the US is being left because they're supplying weaponry day by day. There are flights going through Akrotiri, which is the British base in Cyprus, to put weaponry in to be used in Gaza. And, of course, the leadership in Cyprus, the Greek-Turkish leadership, the Greek leadership in Cyprus and the Turkish leadership are both saying, why have Britain got bases in our country which they can use to supply, to attack our neighbours over there in Gaza? And of course, why are the British in Cyprus? They tried to kick us out, if you remember, but we insisted on staying. And now the bases are being used to attack Gaza. And the people of Cyprus...
They?
Yes, Akrotiri is being used as a basis for sending weaponry into Israel to be used on Gaza. Now, the Cypriots tried to fight us out of Cyprus in the 1950s. Archbishop Makarios, General Grivas, yeah? And we're still doing it.
Well, Henry Kissinger made sure
yes,
that didn't
happen. The Cypriots do not want British bases on their territory. They were forced to accept them as the price of independence, but they don't want them there.
Now, they had Israeli trainee soldiers doing gang rapes over there too, didn't they?
And also British soldiers, which is another bone of contention.
But anyway, we hear a lot about Gaza. What about the West Bank? I don't know if you've seen the pictures this week, Martin. It's pitiful, really, with the pictures of the baby Jesus in the churches. One in the Church of the Holy Nativity in Bethlehem, which has got kind of rubble around it. So, you know, just really making some sort of statement about what's going on over there right now in the Holy Land.
Well, I think the Christian churches of all denominations in the West Bank, especially in Bethlehem, have decided that they're not going to have any celebratory Christmas. There's going to be no Christmas trees, no fairy lights, no joy and peace and goodwill. They're going to have church services which will be conducted in a somber mood. I think that's
an absolutely correct decision.
And of course, they're cutting their throats because they get tourists coming in every year to see the celebrations. But I think they've made the right decision to say, look, we're not going to be celebrating this year. If you come in as a tourist, then don't expect you to get any razzmatazz because there ain't going to be any.
And we'll have some somber carols too. But I mean, that picture of the baby Jesus in amongst the rubble, I'll make sure that's up on our show page at the weekend at thisweek.org.uk. I thought I'd also take a look at this Church of the Holy Nativity, because back in 2002, I mean, this is nearly 20 years ago, there was a horrific siege there with the foreign correspondents, journalists, as well as the local Palestinians and the vicar, canon or whatever they are, of this church being surrounded by the Israeli army. I shouldn't laugh. Surrounded and assaulted by the Israeli army. This is the sort of thing that they do.
The standoff had begun in early April when Israeli tanks had entered Bethlehem as part of a series of raids across the West Bank. As the Israeli army moved into the town, local civilians and Palestinian militants fled into Manger Square. When troops opened fire there, many of them ran into the church to seek sanctuary.
There were a big number of people, you know, and we couldn't also get them outside.
Inside the church compound, which is built on the site of what Christians believe is the birthplace of Jesus Christ, there were now about 200 Palestinians, some of them civilians, some of them policemen, others militants, several heavily armed. While outside, in Manger Square, the Israeli army tightened its cordon.
Exchanges of fire coming from the direction of Manger Square and the Church of the Nativity. Earlier today, along with other reporters here, I tried to get to the area. but we were forced back by Israeli soldiers. The reports coming from the church and the square are confusing and contradictory. I spoke to one Palestinian who's inside the church.
Now the soldiers, the Israeli soldiers, surrounded us from each direction, and they bombed the church, bombed one door of the church and opened a hole in it.
But this account is disputed by the Israeli army. It says soldiers blew open the door of a house near the church, but that they've not touched the church itself.
The media was kept behind a barricade about a block and a half from the entrance to the church, so all of our work was done with long lenses and the whole city was in complete lockdown.
At the start of the siege, Carolyn Cole, who works for the Los Angeles Times, was outside with the other journalists.
Most of the time, everyone was just waiting. Occasionally, somebody would be brought out on a stretcher from inside the church. Occasionally, you'd see soldiers running past, but you couldn't really tell a whole lot about what was going on.
Inside the Church of the Nativity, Father Sabara was beginning to realize that this was not going to end soon.
You know, I was afraid because we weren't prepared for this moment, you know, to have all these people inside.
There was food in the compound. The priests kept a store. But as the siege ground on, food became more and more scarce. The generator for electricity also began to run down.
We used to live day by day. Many times we have to get up during the night because there was a shooting between the people that were inside and these Israeli soldiers.
The days turned to weeks. 8 people inside were killed by Israeli snipers. Some others were wounded. Many of the civilians and the younger people inside were allowed to leave. But for the 100 or so still there, the negotiations dragged on. Then one day, photographer Carolyn Cole had the kind of break that journalists can only dream of. It was late afternoon. She was standing at the barricade when she spotted a group of foreign protesters sneaking around the side of the church.
And so I ran after them, and they ended up running towards the church, the Door of Humility, and the door popped open unexpectedly. And of the 20 that were running towards the door, 10 of them made it inside, and I went in with them.
The protesters had coordinated by mobile phone with some of the Palestinians inside. The door closed behind them.
For me, being a witness to it was extraordinary that I was able to get in there and stay in there for the remainder of the time for those 9 days, because you're the only person that can record what's going on.
Well, I wonder, you know, is this a real journalist or is this a CIA lady that's managed to get in there to be in the middle of in the thick of things? But quite appalling, isn't it? The way that these religious sites, whether it's a mosque or a church, are being targeted by the IDF. And they say, well, this is a den of terrorists, and so we're going to have to snipe away and actually shoot people dead in the church.
Well, I do remember this incident because I went down with some people to hand out leaflets outside Bristol Cathedral about it.
Was from BBC World Service, by the way, Witness History, earlier this year, back in September, and that incident happened back in May 2002.
Yeah, well, I remember it, and I went down with a Palestinian guy and somebody else I knew, and we handed out leaflets about people going into Bristol Cathedral, and then we were invited in to talk to the dean about what the protest was about and so on. Of course, it's very symbolic, isn't it? You know, the Church of the Holy Nativity and the run-up to Christmas, and it was under siege. But, of course, worse things are now going on, as we all know.
So it seems to me that there is no understanding of anybody else's rights whatsoever. There's this kind of very authoritarian, we are in charge. And this is almost a kind of religious-driven or quasi-religious idea. This is why I earlier was talking about religious cults. I just think that's what we're dealing with here. This is the kind of thing. But anyway, as we're talking about Bethlehem, this week I spoke to Mazim Kumzay, who's a professor who lives in Bethlehem. He's an Orthodox Christian. So I asked him about what he thought about the situation there at the moment. And I'll put a full version of this up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Obviously, it's not the greatest Christmas they've ever had.
Before 7 October, Israel held about 7,300 Palestinian political prisoners, abductees, etc. Most of these people are not even associated with the resistance. They they are common people who sometimes speak out against Israel or against Israeli occupation. So after 7 October, Israel nearly doubled that number. So now Israel holds about 11,000 Palestinian political prisoners. More than 40% of them are administrative detainees. That means there's not even a charge given to them. They're just taken and as hostages, basically Palestinian hostages in Israeli jails. Christmas is a season of hope. We Palestinians, Christians, with our fellow Palestinian Muslims, who also celebrate the birthplace of Jesus in Bethlehem. We are 15 million Palestinians. 8 million of us are refugees or displaced people. The rest are all cooped up in basically these concentration camps that are bombed and distorted and destroyed by Israel. That is, Israel is a system of apartheid that wants a land but does not want the people who come with the land. We call on the world to come and assert our common humanity, our international law, human rights, things that the West used to talk about, but unfortunately does not practice anymore, as our government supports apartheid and supports repression.
Massim Kumsio from Bethlehem talking to me earlier this week, and I suppose it is incumbent on us both with actions and prayers to support them, Martin. The thing is, where is this going, do you think?
Well, I mean, predictions are for the foolish, aren't they? It could be that they will be able to grind out a sort of massacre while everybody watches on in horror, which will then lead to huge political effects in Britain, for example, because it's going to be a major issue at the next general election. Well, if we watch a genocide day by day, with the political leadership of the Labour and the Tory parties condoning it, it's going to create a potentially explosive situation right here.
As we heard from Kevin Cahill earlier, the press, I mean, for example, with Question Time, they've just turned their back on the whole topic and they're not even interested in discussing it on BBC's main public questions programme. It's not even mentioned on there, because this is something which a lot of people, if they're trying to catch up with politics, will watch, and it's just sidestepped by the whole so one of the main problems, of course, is the way the press has been covering this. I think everybody has to say that the BBC has done a reasonable job with people like Jeremy Bowen, but in other cases, like with Fiona Bruce, and it's appalling. In fact, it's non-existent coverage. So, and the World Service, as you heard there, did a reasonable job on the Israeli siege of the Church of the Holy Nativity. So we cannot close our 2023 show without mentioning Julian Assange. And there is some good news. I think this is, again, an extract from yesterday's Redacted with Clayton Morris.
Well, first, I just want to emphasize that the core liberty that is being argued over in this case, when you travel abroad, does the U.S. government lose, or do you lose as an American, or do I lose as an American, the privacy rights that I have under the Constitution in the United States? Meaning, now that I've left the borders of the United States, can a government agency, intelligence, national security, or any government institution choose to violate those privacy rights? And particularly when I'm in other buildings that perhaps the U.S. doesn't have full control over, and yet there are surveillance systems or other mechanisms for security that exist, which they could obtain information, video, audio, whatever, and maybe use them to investigate me. Do I lose my right to privacy because I've left the U.S.? That's central to this because we have four individuals, two journalists, two attorneys that met Julian Assange in the Ecuador embassy in London. There's evidence that people like them were singled out as priority targets by a private contractor named UC Global, run by David Morales. And David Morales is known to have gone to Las Vegas Sands, potentially, allegedly in the lawsuit, inked some kind of a behind-the-scenes agreement that allowed the CIA to allegedly outsource a spying operation to him, with somehow Sheldon Adelson being involved. Of course, he's now dead, does not exist anymore. But the allegations in this is that these individuals who tried to visit Julian Assange were targeted simply because they were there talking to Julian Assange. And there was some interest on the part of the CIA to monitor those people so they could use it to facilitate expelling Julian Assange from the embassy. And this case right now, we have not seen a dismissal from the judge. It's extraordinary. Oftentimes, allegations of spying or criminality by the CIA, the NSA, the FBI, they usually can enter a court and just invoke national security or state secrets privilege and say that there's no way that this could be litigated. But the judge in the Southern District of New York is allowing them to continue with this lawsuit at the moment.
So at least apparently it seems, Martin, a little bit of hope for Julian with his quite a hefty lawsuit going on in New York City, saying that, well, they don't really he's undermining really the whole case for extradition by saying that that they've done the whole thing unlawfully.
Well, yes, I mean, because the interfering with his lawyers is illegal in theory, illegal under U.S. law, and they used a Spanish company to do it, which allowed Balthazar Garzon, who's the activist lawyer in Spain, to start prosecuting Morales. So, you know, it's legal battling.
And as he explains there, the idea here is, does U.S. law count when the U.S. is doing prosecutions of foreign citizens?
Well, we all know that in actual fact they break the law all the time, but nevertheless they shouldn't, at least according to in theory. So when they do, it should lead to the case being dismissed. Yeah, if it was in the US, that's what the lawyers would be arguing. You can't interfere with the person's attorneys like that. That's prima facie case that it's got to be dismissed. I'm not a lawyer, so I don't understand the ins and outs of it. I'm sure Balthazar Garzon, who initiated this particular case against UC Global, he does know about these things. He was the one who sent Inigo to prison. He was a minister
Spanish government. The last story we're going to look at is a bit of an occult angle to it, but it's a fascinating thing, I think. The discovery of Gaynor Lord's body in Norfolk in a river. It's got these peculiar echoes with the whole situation with Nicola Bulley earlier in the year. Now, for people that don't know, one of the senior police officers who was investigating Nicola Bulley died. He was 50 years old. Well, it may have been the side effects of the jab. It could have been anything. But the most extraordinary thing was that the ruling was to not conduct an inquest into his death, although a lot of people wanted an inquest in Lancashire, both his colleagues and people who were connected with the Nicola Bulley case. And yet it was ruled that there would be no inquest into the death of this officer who was investigating the Nicola Bulley case. So quite a lot of peculiar things going on around that one. And now this Gaynor Lord one as well. So it put me in mind of an interview we aired earlier this year, and it was with the author William Ramsey, of this book, The Global Death Cult, which is about this thing called the Order of the Nine Angles, the idea that there are certain groups around there that actually will promote people within the group and get a kick out of murdering people. And I wonder if the police are looking into that. They certainly should be.
I think that the Nazarenes were one group they wanted to get rid of. So, and individuals and things like that. And I think, you know, it's not all this is just the information I could get public. I mean, I think that there is an oral tradition, A-U-R-A-L tradition with the ONA of things that, and I know that exists within Crowley as well, the OTO, things that they talk about that aren't written down. But, I do think that there's just so much writing about who they will get rid of and what's the benefit, right? So like if there's a journalist, that's causing problems, get rid of him. That'll advance our way. Things that are in our way politically. So there's a lot of, talking about who they want to get rid of. But you have to like get rid of, to go up somebody who's like the fourth or fifth level of the ONA's septenary way. That means that they've conducted a sacrifice, an opt for sacrifice. It's incredible.
Wow. Yeah, and it's not random killing, guys. It's them definitely testing you. They want to test you, and they want to find out whether or not you're worthy of sacrifice. And it's not like they just kill those that they feel are meek or meager or anything. You've got to show your own willingness to be the sacrifice, or not really willingness, but the traits of a traitor, of you know, I just found it very fascinating how much effort they put into selecting who they would sacrifice and who deserved to die.
Right. No, it is remarkable. And I think it was like, if you're arrogant, if you, you know, this test, if you came out feeling that, if they thought that you were less than, you had low character or something like that, then you were the perfect person to get rid of. You're the first, you know, human culling in action. You'd be ideal. So, you know, that's weird. And it's weird how it ties into kind of what's happening with the smiley face killings, where these young men are out there. There's an overproportion of them who are Christians, and also that they're usually out at bars. So maybe that's like an environment where somebody who was thinking like on ONA terms would see somebody acting drunk or being too loud or being a slob or something. And then they're like, okay, that's the person we're going to off tonight. We're going to ritually drown them and throw them in a river, because they believe in this kind of Typhonic worldview. The trident to them is also important. There's something called the tricycle, which is also very dark kind of symbol. That's a more recent element of the ONA, but it's the idea that there's gods in the water underworld that need to be placated, sacrificed to, but also it's the old kind of battle between the lesser gods and the gods up on Olympus, right? So there could be that same kind of thing today where they're warring against the living god and their dark gods are underneath the water, something like that. It is interesting, like the fourth version of Stranger Things included kind of a portal at the bottom of a deep river. So right. I was like, oh, that sounds just like the ONA. So maybe they started reading something like that.
You can find that in the rituals of the Church of Satan as well.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, they say if you wanted to call upon Cthulhu, which was one of Lovecraft's gods, for those that don't know, that you needed to do it off of a oil rig. And there are a lot of weird things going off the edge of oil rigs as we start to look into that.
Well, they say that the Americans have the best and the worst of everything. Anyway, that's a fascinating podcast from a couple of years ago, I think maybe about 18 months ago. William Ramsey is the author. The book is The Lord of the Nine Angles, The Global Death Cult. And this is stuff which is just completely, you know, poo-pooed by the likes of Private Eye, of course, but lauded by the likes of people like Nick Land, the accelerationist Armageddonist. So, you know, the idea that these cults don't exist, I think, is poppycock, nonsense and silly. Of course they do. And they get promoted up through these groups by conducting these kinds of hideous activities. So let's hope that's not in any way connected with the Nicola Bully or the Gaynor Lord, you know, deaths, there's certainly something doesn't smell right at all to me about this, and particularly listening to the press coverage today saying, oh yes, you know, it's probably just suicide, and yes, it's perfectly normal for people to be rushing around when they're about to commit suicide, nothing wrong with that, it's perfectly normal. I think that's the idea, is to sort of steer people away from really questioning what's going on. We've got a couple of things to finish with. First of all, I'm going to do something kind of similar to this when we come back in January, God willing, to look at the some specifics to do with the Martin Bormann, who I wrote this book about the Bilderberg group, the Traitors of Arnhem, about. He was Adolf Hitler's private secretary, and I've discovered a lot more actually about his role in the persecution of the Jews in World War II. He was very much a central figure in it. The more I look into that, the more hideous it becomes. He clearly was. The Wannsee Conference in 1942 was organised by him. He didn't actually go to it very cleverly, but he sent the person that he'd appointed as the sort of racial chief. But anyway, we'll be talking about that when we come back in January. But here, I thought I'd have a look at the this whole idea of these cults. And this is an extract from a book called Grand Orient Freemasonry Unmasked by Monsignor George F. Dillon. He's written in 1950, this was. He looks at the intellectual and the war party in Freemasonry. He says that at present, all secret societies are divided into two parties, the party of direction and the party of action, or the war party, he calls it. The duty of the intellectual party is to plot and to contrive. That of the party of action is to combine, recruit, excite to insurrection, and fight. The members of the war party are always members of the intellectual party, but not vice versa. The war party thus knows what's being plotted, but the other party, concealed as common Freemasons amongst the simpletons of the lodges, cover both sections from danger. If the war party succeed, the peace party go forward and seize upon the offices of state and the reins of power. Their men go to the hustings, make speeches that suit, are written up in the press, which all the world over is under Masonic influence. They are cried up by the adroit managers of the mobs. They become the deputies, the ministers, the Talleyrands, the Fouches, the Gambettas, the Ferries, and of course, they make the war party generals, admirals, and officers of the army, the navy, and the police. If the war party fails, the intellectual party who close their lodges during the combat appear afterwards as partisans, if possible, of the conquering party, or if they cannot be that, then they silently conspire. They manage to get some friends into power, they agitate. They, in either case, come to the assistance of the defeated war party. They extenuate the faults whilst condemning the heedless rashness of ill-advised, good-natured, though too ardent, young men. They cry for mercy. They move the popular compassion in time. They free the culprits and thus prepare for new commotions. So this, I think, is a fascinating bit of insight by Monsignor George Dillon, Irish, wrote a very interesting book, Catholic, obviously, Grand Orient Freemasonry Unmasked, explaining that these two major international Freemasonry organisations, and we do know, anyone that looks into it, that the main instigator of the Ukraine coup, for example, Viktor Pinchuk, was indeed the master of one of the most powerful, if not the most powerful, Masonic lodges in Ukraine, working very closely with the Central Intelligence Agency. And before we close, let's have the obligatory Christmas poem. This from Patrizia. Thank you again, Patrizia, for your lovely gifts you sent in to us. Christmas is upon us. This year is almost gone. God bless the lively team of three, and God bless us everyone. Throughout the year, we've listened to guests with much to say on their lives in Bristol and from places far away. Tony G's reporting, a journalist extraordinaire. Oh, come on. Martin with his joie de vivre, while Tony debonair. Dave the brave, who keeps the peace when levels through the roof, as Tony's vying for the last word, a trait oft seen in sleuths. But the show goes on regardless each week with much ado. The team of three e'er be friends, regardless of their views. Tony with his interviews, digging deep to find Martin's depth of knowledge. Perhaps he masterminds. No show we know has such a range. 3 hours, gosh, what a task. Our financial support is needed. 'Tis not too much to ask. So let's dig deep this... Thank you, Patricia. Let's dig deep this Christmas to help the show go on, shining light on darkness and for playing real good songs. So happy Christmas to the team. An ode from heart to say gratitude for all you do and for keeping lies at bay, relaying stories with panache inimitable in your way. Joy of joy and truth portrayed, as Tony has his say, at 5 p.m. each Friday on the week, thisweek.org.uk. Lovely. Thank you so much, Patrizia, which takes us to our final clip this week. Absolutely brilliant, of course. Very sad to hear about the death of Benjamin Zephaniah last week. And the BBC, local BBC here, popped this up on Facebook. You know, I'm from St. Paul's. A lot of our stories come from St. Paul's. St. Paul's riots in the 1980s were a subject of the investigation that got me removed from Bristol Community Radio because we uncovered the fact that Valentine Walker, the father of the mayor, had tried to kill the leader of the anti-apartheid movement, Balogun, who was then forced out of the country. But these old stories are there now still, and we've dug them out. And it's important that people understand that this is not the mayor, but the mayor's father, Valentine Walker, was involved in this rather horrific black-on-black attack. And he was also accused very strongly by Balogun of being a police informer. But we're not going to go back there right now. What we will do is to have another piece of a little ode, which also mentions these informers, Benjamin Zephaniah, strutting around St. Paul's here in Bristol back in the 1983.
When you walk the streets of St. Paul's, you see community police presence. But they can't stop the youth, no, that is the truth. Them love them reggae dance. Dread rock rock in a St. Paul's, barled rock there too. Informers try infiltrate, but them don't have a clue. Plenty drink in a St. Paul's, sensi if you want. St. Paul's people living up when society say them can't. The people of St. Paul's are ghetto people, the best that you can find. Don't let the media confuse you and make you change your mind. Plenty of love in a St. Paul's, if you know how to do your thing. Some giant posse of BMW, some of them cycling. A festival coming at St. Paul's, everybody start rehearse. In a bedroom cellar or tent umbrella, well, some people know worse. At festival time in a St. Paul's, you see the unity. There's jazz, there's disco, film and drama, and the best reggae. Children out there rocking, just watch them go and come. And you hear the Rastas chanting chants upon them homemade drum. And all through this recession, there is no money there. But there is unity, and there is unity to spare. In this part of Bristol, them don't care about your skin. And if there's any revolution, here is where it begin. So now you know about St. Paul's. Some say a dreadful place. Cool runnings in St. Paul's, if you know the running place. The people of St. Paul's are ghetto people, the best that you can find. Don't let the papers confuse you and make you change your mind. The people of St. Paul's are loving people, so now you understand. St. Paul's people, upright people, catch them if you can.
God bless Benjamin Zephaniah, gone to a better place. Thank you so much, BBC, for sharing that with us. Time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, and also, of course, to Dr. Philippa Winkler, and to Andy Hudd, who's deputy leader of the Workers' Party, as well as helping run a trade union on the railways. Do please send me interviews and story tips via Not the BCFM Politics Show page, where you'll also find the podcast, full-length interviews, story links, comment page, and our email addresses. Also, of course, you can subscribe to my weekly newsletter and even donate at thisweekoneword.org.uk, and follow Tony Gosling Censored on Telegram. And also, I can't, of course, forget, thanks very much to sound engineer Dave Bazanko. Have a relaxing and enjoyable holiday over the Christmas period. Don't forget to pray and take some action to help the people of Gaza. And join Not the BCFM Politics Show live stream in 3 Fridays' time. God bless. And don't let the satanic banksters get you down.
Why not just get together and live in one love and one unity, you know? Rebel in the morning, rebel in the evening too. Now don't you be like the devil when I flee with sounds called a rebel, rebel, rebel. The man
You can hear what I say, let there be love. Up, y'all. Said I'm a living man and I got a lot of work to do.
Said I'm a living man. Oh, I got work to do.
Means we gotta come on over, rock it with me now. Come rock it on over, baby. Step it on over.
I'm a
rebel. Rebel in the evening.
Oh,
and daddy say you gotta come on over and rock it on round. It's best not a sound or jump to rock it on.
Oh,
so make it an adventure here, dear, and everywhere you can hear me when I say so. Roddy Murray down there. Yeah, so you're gonna rock it on over. Means daddy gotta get stepping on. You know? You stop me running wild.
Thank you.
don't, 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 don't,